One. All right. Good morning, everybody. This is the Friday before Halloween, so this can be a spooky land use and sustainability committee meeting. Hope we don't scare everybody. Welcome, everybody. All right. So welcome, colleagues, Commissioner Richardson, Vice Mayor Fernandez. Okay. Let's start top of the order. No one's asked for any deferrals or open and continued items. So,
Mr. Chair, there's one deferral. Item number four has been deferred by the item sponsor, which is a discussion regarding amendments to the city code pertaining to heritage tree designation. That's been deferred to the November 18th meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
That's it.
Okay. Let's take item number one, which is an LDR amendment to establish alternate member categories for land use boards. This is Mayor Gelber's item. Does somebody want to tee this up?
Sure. I can go ahead and take this, Mr. Chair. This is an item where the item sponsor asked staff to take a look at alternate member categories for our land use boards. And as the committee may recall, when this was referred, we were requested to research what other comparable cities do. And we did some extensive research, and there are a number of Florida cities that are comparable to Miami Beach, including Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, Palm Beach, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Miami Springs, and Miami-Dade County, that have alternate member categories for their land use boards. And they have between two and three alternate members. So we went ahead and drafted an ordinance that created a framework for an alternate member category for our design review board, historic preservation board, and planning board. We didn't do it for the board of adjustment because that would require an amendment to the related special acts, and that would require voter approval. It's something we could do potentially at a later date, but for purposes of moving this forward, we limited it to the three land use boards that wouldn't require voter approval. And what we're suggesting is the following, that up to two alternate members may be appointed by the commission per board, and the appointment process would be the same as regular members, a 4/7 vote of the commission. The alternate members would have to be residents of the city for at least a year, and they would have to satisfy at least one of the criteria in the regular membership categories for the respective board. The alternate members would be eligible to vote when one or more of the regular voting members of the applicable board either has a conflict or is absent from a meeting. And the voting member, and in the event that a regular voting member resigns from or is removed from the board, the alternate member may take their place until such time as the city commission appoints a new member. This was a dual referral to the planning board, and so whatever recommendation you provide today is what we will bring to the planning board. It will have to go back to the commission for two readings, and because it's an LDR amendment, it will require a 5/7 vote.
Colleagues?
Let me ask a couple of questions. Thanks, Chair. If there are two alternates and only one member is out, how would we decide which alternate sits to hear and vote?
We could prioritize the alternates as alternate one, alternate two. If alternate one was not available, we would revert to alternate two.
And is it common to have two? Like, do we have enough? Do we have people, two people out in a meeting? Is that common?
Yeah. It's something where it happens more often than not on all the land use boards. The Historic Preservation Board and Design Review Board, because they have variance authority, a number of their applications require at least five members to be present. And if more than two members are absent, they have a short board. If more than three members are absent, they can't hear variances. And so it's not something that has completely brought the land use board process to a grinding halt. But over the years, we have noticed that there have been meetings where one or two members have been absent or they're unable to participate in significant items because of a conflict. And so certain items will always only have six members or sometimes five members because of a conflict.
And I guess one of my concerns with having two is that First of all, if you have two and then prioritize them, number two might feel a bit less than, right? So, and not equal, and may not want to be an alternate unless they can be the first alternate. And then the other thing is, if the public needs to engage with the board, if there's an item before the board, and then there's a last-minute switch, if you will, just because someone's unexpectedly absent, maybe someone from the community hasn't had a chance to do outreach, and that would be two of seven people, so that may be limiting. I think from what I've heard, I'd be more interested in maybe just saying one alternate and see how that goes, and then if it's not working, then maybe add. But tell me, so what the process would be that the full commission would have to vote, a 5/7 vote to adopt this new rule?
Yes, the ordinance itself creating the alternate member categories is an LDR amendment that would require a 5/7 vote of the commission. If it was adopted either with one alternate member or two alternate members, those alternate members would also have to be approved by the city commission, but the appointment of the alternate members is a 4/7 vote. It would be identical to the regular
members. And there would be an alternate on what we're talking about, the four land use boards?
Three of the land use boards, DRB, HPB, and Planning Board. The issue with the Board of Adjustment is that it would require an amendment to the related special acts, which would require voter approval.
And would there be one alternate for all three, or there'd be a separate alternate for each one of the three?
The way we've drafted it, we're recommending a separate alternate for each board.
Yeah, I think that's a smart idea. So, well, I'd be interested to see what my colleagues think.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. So this is my thought on this. Number one, I feel that if I don't see this really being a problem right now. I served on the planning board, and I can't remember ever being in a situation where the board didn't have quorum, and the board not being able to conduct its business. But I'm open-minded to it because, like, for example, here we are at the Land Use Committee, and all of our committees on the city commission, we have alternates in the event one of us are absent. So with the land use boards, it's a little bit different, though, because with the land use boards, we're talking about categories of seats. So, for example, on the planning board, you have an attorney, you have an architect, someone with background on planning. We have a water seat on the planning board, or we have a general public, general resident, or I think it's resident at large is what it's called, seat on the planning board. On DRB, again, you have very category specific to the role of the DRB, and the same with HPB. Now, when you have a vacancy on an attorney's seat, or you have a vacancy on an urban planner seat, now you have an alternate individual who may not have that expertise filling in that role. And that's a concern that I have with this, because in essence, now when there's a vacancy, pretty much someone... And let me just take this from the angle of the vacancy. And I understand the main intent here is to address absences. But I would imagine this alternate would also serve in the event of a vacancy until a new person is appointed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So in the event of a vacancy, we usually take these vacancies very seriously. We want to address them rather quickly, not to hold up the business and the due diligence, the due process that the public is entitled to with these applications. If there is an alternate that's in place, I feel perhaps we may not be as quick to do these appointments at the city commission because it's not as urgent, it's not as pressing. You already have someone serving there, but that person may not be of the appropriate category, may not be with a landscape background, the urban planning background, or the legal background, or the resident at large position. That's one concern that I have with this. I also feel it might be beneficial to perhaps consider that, you know, some of these boards are very specialized in what they do. The planning board is just very specialized in what they do. So it's the HPB. Why not allow the HPB to select their alternate? why not allow the planning board to select their alternate? You know, or which was the third board, not board of adjustment, design review board. You know, design review board. Why not allow them to select their alternate? Because ultimately, ideally, these are individuals who are professionals in these categories, and they know the role that they play because they've been sitting there. And so I feel it might be beneficial to have them select someone to be that alternate. It kind of gives a little bit of power back to some of these boards and give them a stronger role. So that's kind of how I feel about this. I'm not completely against this. I just don't feel that there is a problem that we really are solving here. I'm concerned about the issue of categories, that the alternate may not fit the category. And I feel perhaps it might be good to give these boards the ability to select their alternate if we do this. Thank you.
Tom, what's your recommendation on this? I mean, it sounds like you're supportive of Mayor Gelber's item, because I think you live with this issue more than we do in terms of board participation.
Yeah, we think that it's a good idea because of the issues that we've had in the past with regard to short boards. And after doing some research and seeing what other cities do, we didn't realize that it was more commonplace than we thought. And so we do think that it is good policy, and that it is something that should move forward. If the majority of the commission or 5/7 of the commission doesn't feel the same way and it doesn't move forward, our land use board process will still continue to move forward. It's not like not having this will bring it to a grinding halt. But with that said, I think it is something that in the long run would be beneficial to the board process.
Yeah, so I mean, we can move this back to the commission, and the commission's going to have to make a vote anyway and do it with or without a recommendation from this committee. I'm not in favor of letting the board members select their own, because I feel like that's why we get elected to make the appointments. And I would support having one alternate for the three boards. So, I can move that and see how my colleagues feel like, but I would move this. I want to move it back to the commission anyway, but I would move that we would adopt this with one alternate for the three boards and then send it back to the commission with that recommendation.
That's how I feel. You feel differently, or?
Oh, I mean, we can send it back to.
Okay. All right, let's send it back to commission 2-1 or 3-0?
Yeah, we're
going to do 3-0.
3-0,
okay.
So rather than taking it to the planning board, we'll go ahead and bring this back to the commission as a discussion before we bring it to the planning board, and I'll bring back the land use committee's recommendation of one alternate per board.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, let's take up item number 2, which is Commissioner Vice Mayor Fernandez's item, potential LDR amendments to commercial district regulations for North Beach in order to limit the proliferation of nuisance uses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sounds like this right up my alley, right?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so much focus has been placed in North Beach, improving North Beach, and we also want to make sure that the commercial character of North Beach is reflective of the direction that we want to be moving in as a city. And you're right, Mr. Chairman, you were the leader in this several years ago here in South Beach. I think you even created the overlay in North Beach as well, the MXC North Beach overlay. And I would like to ask our planning director for the benefit of the body and the public, our current restrictions right now on 71st Street in the TCC and the CD2 districts, what is it that we are prohibiting now? What could we potentially expand? What would you recommend that we look at?
Under the code now, we restrict certain uses along Normandy Drive and 71st Street in the TCC and the CD2 districts. And these include tobacco and vape dealers, packaged liquor stores, check cashing stores, occult science establishments, and tattoo studios. One of the things that we suggested in the memo is that we consider expanding the commercial and high-intensity multifamily areas that these uses would be restricted in as well, and that we consider also adding things like souvenir and T-shirt stores, convenience stores, pharmacy stores, medical cannabis establishments, and then potentially whether or not the committee wants to consider limits on standalone bars, entertainment uses, and vitamin stores. There's a number of other commercial and high-intensity multifamily districts in the North Beach area. It may not be extending these regulations to every single one, but there are other CD1, CD2, TC, as well as RM3 and RM2 districts where certain accessory uses to hotels and apartments are permitted, and those may be worthy of consideration as well.
Thank you, Tom. So I agree, and I believe we kind of shared the same thoughts here. Looking at restrictions as to more convenience stores, pharmacies, we certainly don't want to see any proliferation of medical cannabis or souvenir and T-shirt shops. In fact, walking North Beach with code enforcement and our staff, we've walked into T-shirt stores that appear to be a front for something else. You walk into some of these T-shirt stores and you actually see certain products that seems to be rather questionable right in display and quite conspicuously in display. And it's something that it's just shocking that any business would conduct this business that way. I'm not sure if we necessarily would want to put limitations on the standalone bars or the entertainment uses or even the vitamin stores in this part of North Beach, because I don't want to be overly restrictive in an area where we're trying to encourage growth and economic activity. But colleagues, I would welcome your feedback and your thoughts on this so that hopefully then the city attorney's office together with staff could draft an ordinance that could come back to us that reflects the will of this body.
Thank you, Chair. What I would be curious to see what, Tom, your recommendation is or what the city administration recommendation is on this.
We think it would be a good idea to explore the other commercial districts, including the TC1, 2, and 3, as well as the RM3 and RM2 districts, with regard to including more regulations on these types of uses. And we can come back to this committee with a more formalized ordinance that would specify those geographic boundaries. If there's a will to discuss that.
That's what I think is a good idea, Vice Mayor. I would be in favor of keeping it here, letting staff draft up something so we can look at the meat of it, and then I think we'll be in a better position to opine on it. How do you feel about that?
And I think that's great. I don't want us to move anything to the commission until this body has seen the draft ordinance and is something that we feel comfortable with. I like the idea of expanding into RM1, RM2, because from what I see, that would take it west up to Rue Notre Dame.
Yeah, RM1, it wouldn't expand to because no commercial uses are permitted in RM1.
Okay.
But it would focus on RM2 and RM3 to the extent that we want to control certain of those uses as an accessory use to either a hotel or an apartment.
Okay. And not CD2?
Yeah, CD2 would be the other district we would look at. We would look at CD1, CD2, the TC districts, as well as the RM2 and RM3 districts.
Okay. So I'm supportive of us considering an ordinance drafted with your office and the city attorneys, and I'm willing to make that motion, Mr. Chairman. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
Okay. All right. Is there any specific use that you think we should specifically be looking at restricting? I thought that we should perhaps, given the economic activity, and we want to make sure the area keeps on moving forward, perhaps the standalone bars, the entertainment uses, not including that in the ordinance.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay.
I agree as well.
Yeah. Okay. How about the vitamin stores? And the vitamin stores, because I generally think of vitamin stores as GNC, but then we see on Lincoln Road
they become CBD stores.
CBD quickly, stores.
Yeah. So I would concur.
Yep. Okay. So
I mean, if we overshoot, we can, you know,
always amend.
Go back the other way.
Yeah. All right. So that's
Tom. Sunset Harbor, are they allowed to have tattoo parlors, vape shops, fast food, marijuana stores, anything like that?
I don't think so.
It's a rhetorical question.
No.
And who passed that legislation?
I think you were the sponsor of that.
Yeah. So we're going to come up with an item shortly, my dear friends here who love to say that I'm going to destroy the neighborhood. Forget all the things that I've done for the neighborhood so that we don't have fast food places, marijuana stores, vape, tattoo parlors, proliferation of liquor stores. So when we talk about the item about allowing live entertainment like a piano in a restaurant, I just want to remind my friends of what I've done for the neighborhood before you accuse me of destroying it. But what we're trying to do in North Beach is exactly preserve, you know, or hopefully put us on a path forward where it doesn't become, you know, a district that is, you know, overrun by a nuisance retail. Okay.
What do we think? What's the timing on
this? Sadly, you know, I was not on the commission 20 years ago, or we would have prevented this from happening on Washington Avenue or, you know, even on Lincoln Road and places like that.
Timing, Tom, when?
We had talked about bringing this back in November. We'll have to put something together pretty quickly because we'll need to get it. Unless you're okay with it coming back in January, we can probably give that a little bit more thought.
January is fine.
I think that's better. We got a lot going on, and and we don't want to.
So by acclamation, we'll continue this to January, and staff will draft the initial legislation.
Okay. You got it.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Let's see here. Well, while I have you, why don't we talk about item number 6, permitting live entertainment to promote arts and culture, because we all love arts and culture. This is my item, and, you know, what I want to do, and I'll maybe call on our legal team to tell us what our current legal definition of live entertainment is. And maybe we can take it from there. I'm sponsoring this because I think it's important to promote arts and culture in our city. I think all of us are of that same opinion. I believe, and I've been told by attorneys, that our current definition of live entertainment, if we were to be sued, we would probably lose on First Amendment violations. And so I want to try to, one, correct the language of our legislation, and then also to try to very carefully tailor live entertainment throughout our city so that we can support business, so that we can support and promote arts and culture, and have harmony with our neighbors so that we don't have disturbance of the peace. That's all that this is about. So contrary to what I'm going to be hearing, this is not about having the Rolling Stones come have live music all night long. This is about trying to have arts and culture, and things that we can all enjoy, things that support local businesses and enhance the quality of life of our residents. That's all this is about. So you can come up here and throw out all kinds of accusations and conjecture, but that's going to be a false reading of what we're trying to do. Would you like to tell us what the definition of live entertainment, and then I'm going to ask you some questions.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm happy to do that. So currently, the definition of entertainment in the code includes any live or recorded, amplified or non-amplified performance of any kind. The only exception is for TV, radio, or recorded background music at a level that does not interfere with normal conversation, which the shorthand for that is at an ambient level. So the issue that we've looked at in particular is that music played at an ambient level is not considered entertainment if it's recorded, but that same music or performance, if it were live, would be considered entertainment. So it's really the exception that I think we're looking at in particular.
So, for example, if I plug my iPhone and play music, so long as the ambient level, fine.
Correct.
The same music, exact same recording, at the same decibel level, played by a DJ?
That would be entertainment.
Right. Which is the stupidity of our live entertainment ordinance. Let me ask you, pantomime, which has no sound, is that live entertainment?
That's live performance, so yes, it would be entertainment.
If I wanted to do a book reading.
Also.
Spoken word poetry.
Definitely.
Okay, this is what I'm trying to do, guys. Okay, I'm trying to prevent us from being sued and losing a First Amendment violation, because then the ordinance gets thrown out, and then chaos can ensue. Would that be a correct parade of horribles if we were to go to court and sued by an establishment, lose in court so that our ordinance gets tossed? It creates a vacuum where then somebody can come in and open an establishment for live rock and roll.
Well, and I would just be careful what I say on the record, but we have been challenged in the past. That case was ultimately dismissed by the plaintiff, but
Right. I know you need to be careful, but this is what I'm worried about. One. The other thing I want to try to do is do something that is good for our residents and also good for our businesses, because, you know, I firsthand knowledge a number of businesses that wanted to open up in our city. When they found out about our live entertainment ordinance, they said, no thanks, we're going to go literally to Wynwood or some other place. These would be establishments that we would love to have here in the city. So that's all this is about. So anyway, colleagues, do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, I have some of the same concerns in that I don't understand why you can have a recording of piano music, but then you can't have a live person playing piano. So I would be in favor of crafting something in the form of a pilot program so that we can see how it goes. And with limited days and hours, I think what most people are looking at is, why can't you have a jazz brunch on Sunday in the midday? I'm not looking at supporting anything that goes into the night or the early mornings, but I would be supportive of something that is contained within hours and days, and also finding a way to tailor something to individual neighborhoods and having community input. So I'm interested. I'm hoping that you'll allow some public comment, because I'm curious to see what the objection would be to having a jazz brunch on Sunday afternoon from 11 to 3 or 11 to 4. I'm curious to see what damages someone think the community would endure.
Yeah, so I'm like-minded with respect to like a pilot with sort of reasonable restrictions. Start small, see how it goes, and then if it's a failure, then we just undo it. If it's working, then we can think about other things. Tom, do you have any opinion on how we might do a pilot program, whether it's based on a CUP, temporary pilot program, 6 months with established hours, days, that kind of thing? And I hate to put you on the spot. We haven't spoken about this.
We, as part of the direction of the Land Use Committee the last time this was discussed, we looked at potential pilot program options, and we came up with two. One potentially would be to amend the existing ambient entertainment permit program ordinance, which was adopted in 2019, in order to add eligible areas. The other would be to implement a new pilot to allow indoor entertainment in those neighborhoods that prohibit entertainment, and you could create the types of limitations on a pilot basis that you were just talking about. This could be things along the line of entertainment would be limited to indoor portions of full-service restaurants. It would be limited to weekends. It could be no earlier than 11 a.m. and no later than 11 p.m. the occupant content of the establishment would not be able to exceed 300 persons, and the establishment could have up to 4 special event permits per year. These are just potential components of a pilot to the extent you wanted to further limit them so they were, say, just at brunch or lunch. You could certainly do that. If you wanted to put further increases on the OCC load, you could do that. But that's the type of temporary pilot that could be implemented in those areas of the city that currently prohibit entertainment.
Vice Mayor Friend, is any
opinion? Yeah, thank you. So generally speaking, we want to, of course, enhance the offerings in our city. I do think that establishments that do provide some sort of live entertainment tend to be beneficial. I know I enjoy them when I go to the city of Miami or Coral Gables. I don't think it's right for the character of every neighborhood in the city. For example, I know that, you know, in South of Fifth, if we put this south of Fifth, it's going to generate an amount of calls from those residents that it might end up hurting the business more than helping the business and contributing something positive. And I think it's about identifying the right areas for us to test this at. But more importantly, I think we need to kind of get our house in order right now and how we enforce noise. I don't think we have good regulations right now that provides for an objective enforcement mechanism when it comes to noise. And to the extent that we do any pilot program as it relates to expand entertainment, we need to start by first addressing what we currently allow and establishing, for example, decibel levels. So that if we do a pilot in certain areas, that we do it in a way that we can really regulate this, that's beneficial for the community and for everyone. I don't think right now the entertainment that we do allow, it's not really a fair enforcement. I think we need to be looking at first moving to a decibel system and piloting the decibel system. And maybe it could be piloted together. Maybe it's piloted separately. But I think before we go and do any real policy on live entertainment, we first need to get our regulatory house in order on how we enforce our current laws and modifying these laws so that there's true objective criteria. Saying excessive noise, well, what's excessive? You know, excessive may be one thing to one code enforcement officer and different to another person. Or hearing at a certain distance after a certain time. Well, you know, one enforcement officer may hear something, another one may not. But if we use the technology that exists now to craft a policy that protects the quality of life of our residents, it's a whole different conversation at that point.
So are you advocating to try to put us on a decibel level system?
Absolutely. I think right now the subjectivity of our current code, it's not serving our residents well. I don't think our residents truly feel well served with our laws on noise and how they're enforced right now. And I think changing to a decibel level will serve everyone much better.
I've been looking at this for a couple of years, and so I think it's a good idea for us to look at this. The county uses that system. It's my understanding. I think don't we have an item with the administration right now? They're putting together a recommendation or how they would execute a pilot program, right?
It's something that we discussed here that I brought to this committee, and I think come January they're going to have some proposals to bring to us. And I'm just wondering, would the body feel comfortable continuing this conversation at that point once we know what they're thinking of in terms of the decibel system? Because I think that could help us with our enforcement. I think some of our residents may be against this because of how we've currently enforced our current noise laws. And not until we correct that and fix that will we gain the public trust and support to even consider expanding what we currently have. And so I think first we need to get the laws we have, correct them, fix them, and correct the enforcement mechanism before we expand more.
I think we can work on both at the same time, in that I don't want to wait until we have that in place before we move forward on this. I would be in favor of having staff draft something that's a very limited pilot program, and I would be in favor of keeping it here and bringing it back. And Tom, when I say very limited, I think I heard you say 11 o'clock at night. I would not support that. So I would support something like 11, weekends only, only indoors, 11 a.m. to say 3 or 4 p.m. That's what I would support. And then we could see if that is successful, then we could see if there's any other areas where we might want to expand it. But I would not be in favor at this point of piloting something as late as 11 p.m. So what I'm thinking about is the jazz brunch type thing, or having a piano player inside of a restaurant, that sort of thing. I do like the idea of the decibel level. I started looking at that 2 years ago, and I think it's a good idea. I think there's some challenges because when you're using a meter, you don't always know exactly where the sound's coming from, but that's what the administration is working on to see how they can come up with a program. But so I'd be in favor of having staff draft up something for us to look at that would be a limited pilot program.
Well, I think there's two items, and we'll take comments from the public. One that I'm hearing is sort of a decibel level code enforcement policy. Is that correct?
Yeah,
which I think we need to explore and head in that direction personally. And then the other one is your recommendation about having a pilot program. And, you know, my two cents on that would be, yeah, hours, days, and then potentially the types of businesses. I would start with restaurants, not bars and nightclubs necessarily, but restaurants. And then I would, you know, preemptively permit DJs, because I just think that's an obvious, like, somebody can actually physically play the music as opposed to a recording, because it's a decibel level issue. But that's my two cents on where I would want a pilot program to start.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when Poetry Month comes, all these poetry events and all that, they have to get a special event permit to have these people come and read poems and all that?
And a poetry event would probably, under our current regulations, only be permitted where entertainment is permitted, or subject to a special event permit. Is that right, Tom?
Correct.
Okay.
I gotta take this. This is my 10:15.
And Mr. Chairman, we can look at DJs. I think we are constrained as to distinguishing between different types of entertainment, but we can look at that.
Okay. All right. Sarah, Marilyn, you want to come up? Do we have anybody on Zoom, by the way?
Okay. We have at least two on Zoom.
Okay.
Four, five.
Okay.
Hi, good morning. And I do want to thank you for what you did when it comes to the prohibitions of all those nuisance type of thing. And we do thank you for that. But
And the mooring fields that we're hopefully going to do?
Yeah, what?
And the mooring fields that we'll hopefully get as mooring well? Fields. The mooring fields?
The mooring fields. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's another good idea I had.
Well, we...
I do a lot for our neighborhood, but you seem to forget that.
Well, no, I it's not that we haven't forget.
No, you forget. It's
no,
okay.
No.
Just want to remind you.
No, it's not that we haven't forget, and we do thank you for what you do. It is that you need to listen to what the residents said.
Right, so everything that I just said that I did, I got from residents, but go ahead.
On September 11, 2019, John Aleman brought this up as one of the items, R5R, which is Ambient Live Entertainment, Entertainment Permit Program. And she started that. And at that time, I went off and I got a vote from all the residents in Sunset Harbor, and I bought this vote on that day.
That's the push poll you did.
This is
a push poll.
This is a different vote. This was the vote to keep the current ordinance that we currently have in our neighborhood.
Okay, can I read that? Can you bring it up here so I can read? How it was phrased?
No, you can read it. It was phrased.
Go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
My copy. You guys have a copy because I submitted on the 11th. I submitted the whole thing. And this is not me. Marilyn and I and my team of the board listened to what the residents want. We're talking 193 people who wanted to keep the ordinance and do not have the live entertainment. We had meetings with... icebox, and we discuss having a trumpet, a violin, a piano. But the issue was, he says, well, I can actually monitor the other establishment. I said, you're running an establishment. You're not the police to monitor if the other one. The problem is enforcement, number one. And if it's live entertainment, it's going to be anything goes. For example, Moloko, who is in Santa Harbor, they have outdoor speakers, to my surprise, because they're inherited from the previous one. Last week at 9 p.m., they were playing disco music outside that you can hear it half a block away, and I don't live there. Nobody lives around there, that you can hear it half a block away, people going to Fresh Market. They brought it to my attention, and to me, that's very loud. So you start with ambient. You have ambient entertainment today, recorded music. You can put it at any level. How many times you've gone to a restaurant that you have to overspeak and out loud to hear the other person because the ambient entertainment is so high that you can't hear the other person. Now, nobody knows about that. You know, people that come and visit, they don't know anything about, they can call code, it's too loud, I can't talk to somebody. But that happens many, many times. And the way to enforce that is already with ambient recorded music. That is very hard to do. So we already had, those votes were sent out to keep our ordinance. We've worked very hard for the neighborhood. If the neighborhood says they don't want it, you need to obey by that. Or tell the neighborhood that they don't have to be in the ordinance. They can be, what do you call it, be spaced out, or they can write out they don't have to be included. Exempted, yeah. So that would be something that it would be if the neighborhood doesn't want it. It's not that we don't want it, but we know what's going to happen. We know. And we don't want to be the police. I don't go around in Sunset Harbor and check out Bay Club and check out Barceloneta, and they're out there until 2 o'clock. I don't go around doing none of that. I hardly call code. Like, you know, so that's what I'm saying. Listen to the residents, your residents, in your neighborhood. You live there.
Can I ask a question? So, Sarah, thanks for coming and talking to us. So help me to understand what would be wrong with Icebox or any other establishment having a Sunday brunch from 11 to 3 and having a jazz singer indoors.
There's nothing wrong with it. I agree with nothing wrong with it, but this is, once you open the doors to live entertainment, that would be a very good vendor. He would obey by the laws. He would have the right voice, the right people, the right thing. But that's not everybody. That's not everybody. That's the problem that you have. He will be good, and it's something that I know Icebox probably would have been able to do. But
so we'll punish the good because we're afraid of one or two bad actors.
Well, you know what? It's the residents who told me that. Residents,
right, so I'm reading the way you phrased this, right? So I serve on my board,
right,
where Marilyn lives. This never came before my board. And, you know, not even to get into the issue of how your Sunset Harbor Neighborhood Association is even comprised, because we as a board never elect the persons who sit on your board. So, you know, I think it's just self-selection who represents the neighborhood.
No, it is not. Our selection in the board in Sunset Harbor is selected by board members.
Well, I mean, we never appointed Marilyn. We don't have a board vote, and we have 50 units in my building, and I'm on the board.
You have a person on the board. Ted is on the board.
We've never elected. They self-select, and you just keep re-electing them because you like the way they vote.
No, not keep re-electing. It is elected by the board that each building.
My board has never appointed anybody to your board.
They can actually communicate to the board what is the issue they're having in their building or in the neighborhood. That's the only way to know.
Ricky, look in our minutes, and at a duly called board meeting of our association, both Ted and I were appointed to the neighborhood.
I do not recollect that, but we'll correct that appointment.
So just for the record, we were appointed by our board in a duly
When was that? Because I don't recall.
Years
ago. This is the whole issue. Is we don't have years ago. You're appointed and you just sit there, and this is like our board is comprised of people who would not agree with your position, and you sit on Sarah's board and you speak for the neighborhood, but you don't represent the neighborhood.
Yes,
I do. The neighborhood has changed.
Yes, I do, because Susan, who is the board, the president of Sunset Harbor South Tower, were the ones that appointed me and Jeffrey to the board. So each of the board, each of the boards in each of the buildings appoint a member in our board right. in order to defend their condominium.
If we were to have another meeting in the townhomes, do you think anybody would even volunteer?
Yeah, I will. I will, because there needs to be a different opinion than folks who only live here part-time and who, you know, represent a neighborhood that is long gone. The neighborhood has changed.
Okay. Next time we have a meeting, you can do that. You can put it on the agenda.
I'll take care of that.
Yeah. And let me tell you, Ricky, we are very thankful. And, you know, you don't have to rub it in our face. We're very thankful for everything you have done.
No, I mean, Sarah seems to forget everything.
No, we don't forget.
We don't forget.
But I'll be very, very honest with you. I'd much rather have T-shirt shops and tattoo parlors in Sunset Harbor than have music going on, live music, because, as you know, I live right above Barceloneta. And I think Barceloneta is an amazing operator. I have no complaints, but they do get loud at night, and sometimes it's 1-2 o'clock at night, and they're still outside, and I have to, you know, now it's pleasant, we want to open the windows and the doors, and I have to keep them closed because we can't sleep. Okay, so it's human nature. People get together, they drink, they get happy, the music is loud, then they can hear each other, the music is even louder. So, you know, anything that is at night, it's not good for the neighborhood. I mean, there was a you know, the attorney in, I think it was 408, he moved because his kids couldn't sleep with the noise that was going on in the restaurants.
So let me ask you the same question, and thank you for coming. I've already said I'm not going to support something at night, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. But what would be the objection of having 11 to 3 or 11 to 4 p.m. and having a Sunday jazz brunch?
I think that would be very nice if you could control the noise. If you could actually control the noise, that doesn't turn into something at night,
I totally agree. I would not support something at night, but I think it's something that would enhance our communities to be able to have a jazz brunch as opposed to someone having to drive to Wynwood or drive to downtown Miami to have that experience, you know?
That would be fine, Mr. Richardson. And what is not fine is, first of all, I have a problem with the concept that music in a restaurant is arts and culture, because it's not. Arts and culture are our theaters, our museums, concerts. That's arts and culture. This is for the benefit of the restaurants, and that's fine. I'm very supportive of our businesses, because otherwise, what would be Miami Beach without our restaurants? But don't confuse. Don't confuse.
I would say it's a form of arts and culture, and it's not just for the benefit of the owner. It's a benefit of the patrons, because people want to go and have that experience on a Sunday. So there's a benefit for the community. So I'm not going to support something at night. I would be supportive of a pilot program that has a sunset. Maybe the pilot is a one-year sunset, and it goes away unless the sitting board decides to extend it if it's working. And also, I think that we need to do some more work on this decibel level thing. That's something that I started talking about 2.5 years ago because of the concerns on Ocean Drive and having different code officers, you know, having a different standard. If you have better hearing than somebody else, it can change. So I do think that we need an objective standard. So I think what you all could best help us do is to try to create a pilot program that is reasonable, that has limited hours, and work with us on that. Because I think that there's a way to have a pilot program. And I'm thinking specifically Sunday jazz brunch, or I don't know that establishments would even want to do something on a Saturday afternoon. But, you know, I just don't see anything wrong with having a weekend experience like that, And we, yes, we have to control the noise. Absolutely.
But that, you know, what? That is a good suggestion. But that's not what is presented to us when it comes to live ambient entertainment throughout the whole Miami Beach. That's not what is presented. That's a very good point until 4 p.m., however you have it. But that's not what was presented.
I don't think anything's been presented.
Nothing's been presented.
Because your ambient entertainment is throughout the whole Miami Beach. It doesn't say anything about his brunch.
It's literally a discussion item. We're literally talking about it. There is no proposal.
Yeah, we haven't.
It's been talked about since 2019, Rick.
Yeah, there's nothing being proposed in terms of days, hours, or location. I mean, we're literally talking about this. By the way, I'm reading your push-pull. So, anybody who is objective would say that this is not a fair poll.
Yes, it is.
Well, let's read the language. So this new ordinance claims to only permit live entertainment at quote-unquote ambient levels, but this is vague and an unenforceable standard. So right away, the language is colored. This is not an objective poll. No. This is your opinion to say something is vague and unenforceable. That's a fact. While permits would be issued by a different authority, noise complaints would be still inspected by the same old code officers. So this is colored language to tilt the vote. I mean, bring in any pollster and they will say that this is not an objective poll. This is colored language to make people vote a certain way. That's a fact, Sarah. Sorry.
Well, you know what? The prohibition that we have in place in Sunset Harbor was voted by the city, and it was actually discussed in many of the meetings that would not want live entertainment. And it was vetted here, and we worked very hard to do that. What you, Mr. Richardson, what you suggested is great, but that's not what we've been hearing since 2019. All we hear is about live entertainment, ambient music, which you cannot control unless you have some type of noise or something you're able to control and enforce.
Let's do this. Let's forget about what happened in 2019, please. Let's forget about it. And let's start a new day, all right? So what I would love, and you know, you can email me or call me, start thinking about what you think a reasonable pilot program would be, because I think we're going to have staff draft up something, and we want your input. I'm not looking at doing something late at night. I'm looking at something that stops in the afternoon. Okay. So start thinking about what you think would work in your community. Now, can remember, like, somebody can still play this recorded music late at night, right?
Yeah.
And this is where I don't understand, you know, like, you can play a recording of piano music, but you can't have a piano player. But I'm not looking at changing that. I do think that, as Ricky said, that if we got a legal challenge, we would have issues. So I'd rather have an ordinance so that if we did get a legal challenge, we can say, well, here's our law, and we do allow it. So I would start thinking about that. The vice mayor has said that, you know, he wants to work on the ambient, and I am very supportive of that objective measure. But I think we can do both things at once. So I would be in favor of having staff start drafting up something that would be a very limited pilot program with maybe a one-year sunset, and have something very limited hours, 11 to 4 p.m. And then I think work on, I don't think legally we can restrict the types of music or the types of entertainment, but I think we're going to be working on the decibel level thing at the same time. That's all I'm going to be willing to support is something in the afternoon.
I think the city really needs to get its house in order and control what is going on in the entertainment district and everywhere else about noise. You know, before we expand, we're opening a Pandora's box. This is exactly what is going to happen. I mean, if you want to have your ordinance and try it, but the city cannot control what is going on now, and we want more of the same? I mean, that's crazy.
Mr. Chair, the one thing I want us to be very mindful of as a community, not just as a body, as a community, the one thing I will not tolerate at all is, you know, this unbenign, not here, not from the individuals in front of us. It's not about the individuals in front of us. It's about calls I've received.
this quiet racism that we, and I'm just going to put it out there because let's just talk about the reality of what we're dealing with in our community. We like to think that we're very progressive, that we're very inclusive, that we're very accepting. I have seen at times our community not be as inclusive and as accepting as we'd like to think that we are. And that I just want to make sure that we really stick to the fact that we are regulating noise, that we're not regulating race, and that we're not regulating people. I want to regulate noise. Noise causes a problem in our community, whether it's coming from a phone, from a DJ, from a trumpet, or from anything else. It's noise that I want to regulate. And I just get concerned because sometimes the community hurts itself. The community wants to regulate noise, but the examples that the community sometimes uses from calls that I've received is something that concerns me because I need to say it publicly because we're not leaders unless we address this, and we need the community to be mindful of it. We cannot try to regulate race and who visits us using our entertainment laws.
Well, thank you for saying that. I agree 100%, and I'm glad to have you as a colleague because in my 7 years, I've said the same thing. Sadly, I'm in the minority because a lot of the stuff we're doing legislatively is a cover for race issues, and it abhors me that we do these things. So thank you for saying that, and I agree 100%. I'll leave it at that, but I will support you in anything you want to do with that. Okay, we have some callers.
Yes, the first caller is Bruce Backman.
Okay, Bruce, part-time resident. Hi, Bruce.
Ricky, good morning. Your usual contentious self. Thank you. Regarding,
are you in Miami today, or are you in Maine?
I am sitting right in my here in Sunset Harbor. I'm not in Maine. I'm here 7 months a year. Thank you. And if you let me speak, hopefully without interrupting, you concerned about the First Amendment lawsuits. I would remind both you and Commissioner Richardson that also applies to whatever is offered as entertainment. You cannot say we're going to have a jazz brunch and then decide, well, you can't have heavy metal. You can't have trumpets, you can only have violins. You cannot, once you allow entertainment, you have to specify, you cannot specify what type of entertainment it is. So that is the first thing. I think you should wait for the decibel ordinance to be in place so that you have something that's enforceable. Right now, we've had, just in one building alone, 2 illegal nightclubs open till 5 a.m., got them shut down. We have an existing restaurant which knew and applied for a CUP that entertainment wasn't forbidden, but still filed for a BTR allowing entertainment. They were hauled before the planning board. They certainly were not intended. They said they wanted to be a new Purdy Lounge. We all know who the place is. You're asking us to trust that they will obey the ambient level, which is unenforceable because it is totally subjective. Who can define what the level of normal conversation is in Miami Beach? I go to some restaurants, people are screaming. Other places, they are not. I have a question for the attorney. Is changing the definition of entertainment, that is a land use ordinance, that would require 5/7 vote from the commission? Could you let me know that?
That's correct.
Okay, so you require 5/7 vote. You should have a new decibel standard in place that is actually enforceable and with a track record before you open up this entertainment. Otherwise, we have good operators. They do get punished because there are bad operators. That happens throughout the city. If you had a meaningful enforcement of noise ordinance, there would be none of these objections from residents. They would simply see places shut down and disobey. But right now, it is almost impossible to get code enforcement to cite. When they do cite on appeal, these fines are almost always overturned. And that is the problem. You need an enforceable system first before expanding entertainment.
Mr. Backman, your 2 minutes are up. Our next caller is David Suarez.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. The lady who spoke at the podium was spot on. If you allow this, it's going to open up Pandora's box. to not only South 5th, where I live, but every neighborhood. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of these businesses, restaurants, they'll start with best intentions, then they may get bought out, and the new owners aren't as mindful of the residents when it comes to noise and ambient music, etc. I mean, I live across the street from Minibar. I like Minibar. I get a drink there, but a lot of times they forget to turn off their speakers. They have, you know, rowdy crowds, and it causes a lot of collateral noise in the neighborhood during that time. Granted, that's at night, but like I said, you know, with the best intentions, if you want to say between 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., before you know it, it's till 5 p.m., and then it's to 6 p.m., and then code enforcement's not coming around to making sure that it is, you know, to whatever cutoff time it is. And like Bruce just said, if they do get fined, they get it overturned, and it's no big deal to them. So I'm all for arts and culture. I think Miami Beach is a great place for it. I think Commissioner Arriola, your head's in the right place as far as diversifying our community, but we really need to take it slow and make sure that this doesn't erode further the quality of life in South of Fifth. Thank you.
David, let me ask you a question while I have you. And you live South of Fifth. I lived there for 20 years. I love the neighborhood. How would you feel about an establishment, 700-person occupancy, live outdoor entertainment? Would you be in favor of something like that?
700-person occupancy?
Yeah, outdoor live entertainment.
No, that would be ridiculous here.
Yeah, so that's Monty's. Would you want to close Monty's and prohibit? Because they have live entertainment outdoor.
I've never seen 700 people.
But that's their occupancy license, and they have, because they're grandfathered in, live outdoor entertainment. And I think, you know, most people would agree, South of Fifth, that it's a neighborhood enhancement. It's a great place to go, you know, celebrate and have fun with family and friends. But, you know, Monty's is a neighborhood amenity. I mean, in fact, voters turned down 2 years ago a proposal to redevelop that site, mostly because they wanted to preserve Monty's. And Monty's is a 700 occupancy live outdoor entertainment beneath two major condos, and nobody seems to have a problem with it. So I'm just saying, like, you know, when we start doing this parade of horribles,
I completely understand what you're saying. And, you know, I've eaten at Monty's. I've enjoyed their live music there too. But I believe when they were approved the permit for that, it was specifically for that property because of the location.
Well, and, they're grandfathered in. The reason we have live entertainment at all in the city is because it's all grandfathered in. Under, you know, sort of the most recent commissions where we, you know, bend over for, you know, the vocal minority, we have prohibited live entertainment throughout the city. And the only reason I think we have any kind of a vibe in this city is because of the establishments that have been grandfathered in. I mean, if the vocal minority had their way, we would be a sleepy town like Naples. And that's why all right. the marquee entertainment is happening in Wynwood, Brickell, and other places, because we have such prohibitive legislation.
I get it. We don't want to be like a sleepy town like Naples or any other West Coast cities. And I understand it was grandfathered in, but Miami Beach was a different city when it was grandfathered in. It was a completely, now it is completely changed. You know, we are losing residents than gaining residents. That's a fact. And we want to keep residents here. We want to keep the people that stay here. We want them to live here and be happy. And this is, we don't want to make Miami Beach a shell of a city where it's mostly just tourists. We want to encourage people to live here, raise families.
Mr. Sarraz, your 2 minutes are up.
I understand.
Okay.
All
right, David, thanks for your call. Thanks. Just 2 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, we have a few more online. Okay. We also have someone who'd like to speak in person.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Elaine Litvak. I live at the Murano, which is borders on South Point Park, which is east of Monty's. It's all residentials. It's all condos. It's a residential neighborhood, and I assumed and I knew that there was a noise ordinance. I'm here to talk about the noise and the decibels that are so loud that are coming from South Point Park. South Point Park, I do not know what is happening there, but every Sunday, hundreds and hundreds of people are coming to hear bongo playing that is amplified. And no one is saying anything about it. And last week, I was on my porch. Now, you have to realize about decibel noise. It travels up. I'm on the 23rd floor of this condo, and the noise is louder than if you are walking by. But they have live bongos, hundreds of people, having a good time, behaving themselves, of course, but the noise is absolutely deafening. I called code. I asked Cold, I said, what is going on here? She said, I'll take care of it. And an hour later, the noise is worse than it ever was. And I called her back and I said, what's going on? She said, well, I called the park rangers, which obviously did nothing. I said, lady, there's hundreds of people out here. She said, hundreds of people? She sent me right over to the police. She connected me. Within 15 minutes, the police were there. Then after it, no noise, and then it started up again, but much quieter. But I want you to know that noise rises. First of all, there shouldn't be bongo drums, and this is happening every single Sunday. They've gotten away with it because most of the community is not back, but the community is back. We have our doors open. We want to sleep with our doors open. This is Sunday night, and I don't understand. I do want one last thing I want to say is our Murano has a beach club that borders right on the park. We have parties, but we don't dare have any live entertainment or anything amplified because we know it's the noise code. And then to have this going on in the park, I just don't understand. And I really want you to address this and to realize that noise rises. Thank you very much.
Okay, our next caller online.
Nick, if I may, ma'am, and I'd love to meet with you about this. We can't regulate. I don't think we should be regulating the amount of people in the park, but certainly there shouldn't be any amplified music in the park. And from my research in this, I believe that from what our constitutional attorneys have expressed to me, the instruments in the park are protected by First Amendment. But what I don't think is right is the amplified. I don't think that there should be anything amplified in the parks, especially in such a dense area where you have buildings, and you're right, noise does travel up. And I know you emailed me, so I'm going to reach out so that we could meet. Thank you.
Our next caller is Kathy Anderson.
It's not part of the pilot program.
Hi there. So thanks for allowing the public input on this. I'm a South of Fifth full-time resident and have been for 20 years. And, witness, I'm not going to repeat anything that's being said. I think what everyone's afraid of is that you have some bad players that ruin it for everyone else. You know, again, we're all concerned that this will get out of hand, that it's not going to be enforced. The example that was just given in South Point Park, you know, that's great down there. But, when it's not controlled, it can get out of hand. So, again, without repeating everything that's been said, I guess my question is, what would you be doing in terms of enforcement and also of the consequences? Because we all know that the fines that can be imposed, you know, can be of little significance for the operators that are just going to disregard it or do their own thing. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how, you know, even in a pilot program, you would contain that? I'm all for, you know, restricting the hours to something that's reasonable. I think it does, you know, it's a nice enhancement, but we're all concerned about the enforcement and that the magnitude of the consequences are big enough that it is a disincentive and the operators are just not going to flagrantly disregard anything because they can either get fines overturned or they're just not big enough to cause them to worry about it.
Next.
Our next caller is Celia Gruss.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. Celia Bruce, living all year long resident in Sunset Harbor and concerned about ambient music and in our neighborhood. It's so interesting, the last call, the lady who came in right before the last call just said how ineffective the code was. And there's so many things. I don't want to repeat what everybody said. We're just, we understand the good intentions. I'm coming from the music industry. So I live and breathe music. But I know, for example, when we had Pura Vida open and they're across the street from where I live, right away, the first 3 days, they had their ambient music. Well, hell, I could hear it on the fourth floor. And we had to come over once, and we had to come over twice, and we had to come over three times to remind them that that was not allowed. And so I understand, a complicated issue. I'm for business. I love music, but I understand that it is very possible that it is just like a Pandora's box. You open up this and then they want more. And, you know, there's so many wonderful neighborhoods very close where we can have music, live music, and I just want to be real careful. I like many other people that live in the neighborhood, are not for ambient music for all of the reasons that the people have called in for and are present today to speak. And I hope that, and I just also want to take note that you commissioners are representing us, and we just feel kind of aggressed. I've been listening to the beginning. Man, it's tough.
Ms. Gruce, your two minutes
are
up.
So please represent us. Please listen.
Our next caller is Nick.
Morning, Nick.
Yes, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you all for your service. I'm a full-time resident at Sunset Harbor, and I think my views more or less have been expressed in aggregate by other people, but I am also of the opinion that, you know, I would like to see jazz brunch sounds good, but my experience is, you know, bass waves don't respect walls or streets or anything like that. Musicians tend to play louder as the day goes on. And, you know, bars and restaurants like to keep their doors open. And it's very, very difficult to get them to contain it once it's out of the, it's started. So I am also in the camp of, I'd really like to see, potent, practical regulation of noise before we start opening up the neighborhood to more noise. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Our next caller is Miles Sheffitz.
Morning, Miles.
Hi, Commissioners. Thank you for your time. I am a full-time resident south of Fifth. In fact, I've been here 27 years. I'm also in kind of a unique position because I'm also a business owner here. I own restaurants and I also have tenants in this area. I am I'm fully supportive of this legislation. In fact, I think it's brilliant. I think that what we currently have is very antiquated. I have a specific instance which, you know, kind of is a head-scratching instance. I have a tenant that's a great restaurant tenant, a small restaurant called Intimo, and they had a violinist indoors, fully encapsulated, and they were shut down. And it's kind of embarrassing and hard to even explain this. I will say that I like the pilot idea because, you know, people in this forum seem to think that this could get out of control in the proverbial Pandora's box is always something we're concerned with. But I think what we need, and I've heard this on this call, is we need decibel ratings and we need to really figure out what is ambient music. I'm fully supportive of indoors and fully encapsulated. So, you know, as Commissioner Richardson said, I don't really understand what the difference is between a piano player and a recording of a piano player. So I think that, you know, I don't think anybody is against this, because if they really stopped and thought about it, nobody in their right mind would really be concerned. What they're concerned about is outdoor noise or noise emanating from a premises. So I think that maybe it's not, and I'll leave this to the smarter minds, which you guys are. I think that there has to be some kind of quantifiable solution to this. And it can't just be a slap on the hand, that it can't just be code, you know, a code compliance and special master.
2 minutes are up.
It needs to be something like a, maybe if I could just have one more.
Miles, time's up. Anybody else?
One more, Mitch Novick.
Okay. Good morning, Mitch.
Hi, good morning, Ricky and everybody. Mitch Novick. I live in the crime-ridden and noisy Ocean Drive Entertainment District. My neighborhood 30 years ago was thriving with residents. I've always argued the t-shirt shops, pizza parlors, scooter rental shops, tattoo parlors, smoke shops are a byproduct of the noisy businesses, which unfortunately our leaders still embrace. Noise should be contained to the property lines. Noise attracts noise, and I would urge you to table this matter until such a time when you could get mining under control. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch. Anybody else? Okay. Let's try to conclude this. Commissioner Fernandez, I think you were advocating to study a decibel level whether it's a pilot or move forward with actually policy. I'm very open and supportive of something like that. What are you thinking?
I am very much in favor of us piloting for our city a decibel policy, working with the private industry and testing equipment, not just testing a policy, but testing equipment and testing an enforcement mechanism, seeing what that policy that our city administration and the city attorney's office is drafting first and that they're going to be bringing in January. I would feel much better speaking about doing anything else at that point once we know what a potential decibel system pilot program could look like, because that's the start of us correcting, I think, our enforcement on this. I think that the community doesn't feel well served by our current regulations or by our current enforcement, not to no fault of our code enforcement, but the code enforcement can only enforce the laws that we have in place. And I feel we shouldn't be changing these laws and expanding until we find a path to correct this. And it sounds like in January they're going to be bringing back a potential pilot program for the decibel system that hopefully will provide objective criteria through which we can truly enforce noise in our city.
So where, Tom, where is that item is before this committee or before the full commission, the thing you're working on for the decibel level?
That item is before this committee. It was discussed last month, and it was continued to the December, now January, meeting with direction for the administration in consultation with our sound consultant to come back with a framework for a decibel pilot. We've already had one meeting with the city attorney's office, code compliance and planning. We are in the process of engaging our consultant to develop that framework, and our plan was to bring that back to you at your January meeting.
Okay, and legal is, let's say that we have this pilot program for the decibel. Could that pilot program just be a pilot to some program that similar to what we're talking about today, or would it have to be a citywide noise pilot?
I think we're talking about doing the decibel pilot starting on a limited basis. These can travel together or not.
It seems to me that maybe since that's a pilot and we're talking about a pilot here, doing the pilot on the decibel as it relates to this particular program, and then they'll both be very, very limited. So I think that we can work on both at the same. So I want to continue working on the decibel level. I'm very interested in seeing where that goes. I was looking at that 2.5 years ago, so I'm glad that we're moving forward with that. But I would be in favor, and I will move that to have the staff start drafting up something and bring it to us in January. That would be a very limited pilot program for this the subject matter that we're talking today. And, you know, just in terms of guidance, what I will support is 11 a.m. to 4 or 5 or 6 p.m., and that would be weekends only. It would be totally indoors. If it's a holiday weekend, I think it could extend to the Monday or the Friday. I think that's fine. And also I'd ask staff to look at you know, whether or not you think as part of a pilot program we ought to give establishments 2, 3, 4 special permits a year to be able to do something a little bit later, not into the late night hours, but if it's a holiday weekend especially. But that's something I would let staff look at and see what you would recommend. So that's what I'd like to see, and I'll do that in the form of a motion to have you work on a draft and bring it back here in January along with the decibel. And I would be in favor of taking this pilot program, the decibel level pilot program, and having it applicable to this program, because I don't think we should have a pilot program that would be citywide, because that's the whole purpose of a pilot is to test it out. So that's how I'd like to see it go.
You have the support to move this far. I can't support this today. I want to see the decibel system first. I really feel that our existing laws today, we need to fix that first. But it sounds like this is going to be coming back in January, possibly together with the decibel system. So we can further discuss it there, but I can't support the motion today. I just feel the current laws, we need to fix the current laws and the current enforcement system. And I look forward to see what they bring in January.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, please go.
Let me ask, I had one other question I wanted to ask. Is it illegal and or appropriate that if we had a pilot program for this type of music that we could charge the establishments a fee for getting that sort of, I guess it would be maybe a conditional use permit, or would we, is that not permitted?
We could do it as, and the way Tom and I have discussed it is that would be, on a permit basis, a term of 1 year. We could charge a fee for review of the permit. If we're doing it on a pilot basis, it would be revocable. We'd have strict enforcement. We want to make sure that we're not creating a vested right situation, so we would not want to send these to the planning board. But we can certainly charge a fee.
So I would also want that included in the draft, that these would be only applicable to when someone has filed a permit. That way we know exactly where all of this is would be allowed as a pilot throughout the city, as opposed to just opening it up. And that way, if somebody's doing something without a permit, and then the other thing I would be supportive of is whatever permit fees we would charge for this, that those funds be used to support code enforcement so that we could have, make sure that we have, and maybe what it means is we're going to have enough funds that we can hire a dedicated code person to as part of this pilot program.
I got a question. So to the attorney, Collins Park, for example, do we allow live entertainment in Collins Park?
I would defer to Tom, but I believe the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Subject to conditional use approval, the RM2 areas were a carve-out to allow outdoor entertainment subject to conditional use approval. And indoor entertainment is also permitted subject to conditional use approval.
Okay. But in Sunset Harbor, we don't.
Correct.
Right. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see between now and January if maybe staff engages with some of our neighborhoods and see, are there neighborhoods that are open? Is there a neighborhood in North Beach,
you know, on some of the commercial areas that are trying to bring life and activity that might be open to being part of this pilot program. Again, I don't think south of Fifth makes sense because it's gonna hurt over there. It seems to me that there's not support for right now from Sunset Harbor. But which neighborhoods are actually supporting this? And I think there could be neighborhoods that are supporting this, because I do hear from individuals that tell me that they moved down here because they wanted that entertainment, that activity. So I would feel better, you know, besides the decibel system, if we actually knew the specific neighborhoods that we could actually be considering to implement this in. Because right now, just a blanket anywhere in the city or in areas like south of Fifth and Sunset Harbor, I wouldn't feel comfortable with that.
Let's bring this in for landing. Tom, you're going to work on, or Nick, a decibel ordinance?
We're already working on that under a separate item that's pending before land use. That'll be coming back to you in January.
And then you'll draft something with a pilot program for our consideration based on our conversation today?
I believe, and Commissioner Richardson, correct me if I'm wrong, your motion was...
And I seconded his motion.
Was to come back in January with a pilot program based upon the parameters that you set forth. And Mr. Chair, did you also want us to come back with some information regarding DJ, ambient DJ?
Yes, I would. Moreover, you know, I'd ask our city attorney to look at our current live entertainment language and potentially draft something that would survive a court challenge. You okay with that?
Yeah. Tom, let me ask one other question. Because I know we've had a number of comments about the proximity of certain establishments to residential. One of the things that you might want to look at, no, not might want, I want you to look at, is, you know, I'm looking at something very limited for this pilot in terms of hours. But I want you to think about whether or not there may be certain establishments where there's no residential within 200 feet, 300 feet, 400 feet. And so you should think about whether or not there's a different, they would have maybe a different time period. You know, maybe they do get to go later because there's absolutely no residential around there. So just I want you to think about that. Obviously, the closer residential is to the establishment, the more sensitive I am to the noise, which is why I'm limiting the hours. But if there's no residential close by, then that's less important. And I don't agree that this is opening Pandora's box, because this is a pilot program and I wouldn't want to see it the draft sunset in a year. That way, if whoever's here sitting in the commission doesn't, if it passes, and it may not pass again. It's a pilot program, just so we can see how it goes. And I would encourage the public to give us your input. You know, other, Sarah, other than no, right? Like, work with us here. So what do you think would work in your community? If you don't think it will work at all, then that's what you're going to tell us.
I think, you know, if you have to try it. Sarah, you should be on the record.
If you have to try it, I really think you should try it where there are residents. You know why? Because you're going to see whether it really works or not. Do it the way you said it, but also where they have residents, because then you're going to know, and they can complain about it if they had to. We will talk about it in the ward. I will get input from the residents if something, you know, what they want to see, and I will give you the input, because I think it's a good one. It's not, you know, like I said, we're not totally against it, but, you know, the neighborhood.
You just don't want it out of control. I get that.
Right. And I think hopefully if you fix the noise and you do the noise and that gets controlled very well, then this will be something that you can actually have, and you know that you're going to be able to enforce it. Our biggest issue talking to, you know, to the people has been enforcement, always been. So I think you're in the right track if you get that noise thing going.
Okay.
I think it will be
Sarah, you and I are on the same page on this issue. Everything you just said, I agree with. right? We're on the same page. I mean, I want to better our neighborhoods. I want to support our businesses. I want to enhance the quality of life. I don't want things to get out of control. I don't want things to, you know, be a nuisance to neighbors, right?
But I want
to try to, right? I just want to put us on a path where we can do better. That's all we're trying to do here.
And you know, you can come and talk to us any single time. We're very open, and we're very. I have 10 board members. 2 just changed in the North Tower. So I have very good board members who listen. I mean, they might have my opinion. We all have opinions, but we have to vote. There's 10 of us, and I have 2 of them just in case somebody fails and it's not there. I'm able to get a vote. But you can talk to us. It's not like, you know, don't be so aggressive with us. Just work with us.
Gotcha. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for everything. Okay, let's conclude this item.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to show this done as 2-1?
Yeah. Mr. Party Poop over here voted no.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's stay on Sunset Harbor. You guys want to do item number 11?
Sure.
Discuss an amendment for Sunset Harbor perimeter restaurants. Do we have folks that want to tee this up? I think Mr. Finvarb and Sarah, I know you're very involved in this. I'm sponsoring the discussion item. I'm not totally briefed on where things stand, so if you guys want to inform us on what's going on.
And Mr. Chairman, how much time would you like me to set for the proposer?
I don't know. How much time you need, Mickey?
Just intro, a couple minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
Ready? All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mickey Murrah from law firm Burke, Coverdell, Fernandez, Larkin, and Tappanis with me today. Mike Urente and Tracy Slavens in our team, and Ronnie Finvarb, the owner of the property and the developer. Just a little bit of background. I think you all will remember about a little more than a year ago, Mr. Finvarb had purchased this property prior to any discussion of what later became a hotel prohibition in this area. He obviously bought it for the purpose of a hotel as an accessory, you know, use for his Palomar Hotel. So at that point, you know, we had to reconsider what to do. Took some time, and we believe we have really a fantastic project that we feel will be an asset, not only to him, but to the neighborhood. We had heard during the discussions of that prior ordinance, there were some things mentioned like a garden or a park, and unfortunately those uses did not pencil out on his business model. But one of the things we heard was a food hall. While this is not entirely a food hall, it is 2 distinct uses for restaurants that we believe will be welcome here. One of them is a more of a market use. You could, like, I don't want to say epicure, but that type of thing. Walk in, high quality wines, high quality meats and breads, and that type of stuff. The other one is more of a traditional restaurant on the second floor, and there's 3 store. There's 3 stories of residential units, 12 units, and it's got a pretty cool design. We've already gone to the planning board for approval. They have approved the conditional use for this project. We went to the design review board last month. It was continued because they wanted to see a model. We were back before them this coming Tuesday and hope to get approval there. The only thing that this is asking for, this ordinance, is some relief on the requirements of the second-story restaurant. And under the Sunset Harbor regulations, a restaurant above the ground floor can only have 40 outdoor seats and must close at 8. We want a high-quality restaurant that's going to be successful. And as you can imagine, most restaurants that are successful in this neighborhood are open past 8 o'clock. Yeah, most restaurants that will be successful, it's not a brunch restaurant. It's a traditional restaurant with a dinner service. We need it to be open past 8 o'clock. And we want to take advantage of the beautiful views really facing the Palomar, nowhere near where the residents are. The outdoor seating is going to be in the corner of Alton and Dade, and would be really facing his other hotel. We would want more than 40 seats outdoors. We also wanted, in the proposal, there's outdoor speakers. I know there's been some concern about that. The outdoor speakers are not meant to be, I mean, I guess this relates to the prior conversation, a party type of speakers. They're meant to drown out the car noise that you're going to hear from Alton and Dade. So that's all that this ordinance does. It relaxes those uses on the restaurants, and we think it's reasonable and necessary for this project to be a success.
Okay. Yep. Good summary. I mean, look,
yeah.
I'm supportive. You know, Mr. Finvarb, I think, has a great reputation in this city, and the projects that you've done in our neighborhood are first class. He has my trust, but
Let me ask a question. So we just got through talking about a pilot program. So if we do a pilot program, you understand it's outdoors. You're not going to be able to have a jazz brunch outdoors. You know that.
Yeah, we're not proposing any entertainment at this time in this yeah. use. So if that changed in the future, you would love to have some sort of use like that.
But this is just for
eating.
The plan is a ground level retail experience of, I guess, food and wine, right? And then second is a restaurant, and then did you say three levels of
residential units?
Yep. So is it a 5-story building?
It's a 5-story building, yes.
And there are 12 units in the residential?
12 units, yes.
Okay.
And just to clarify, the ground floor, it's a little bit retail. It's kind of a hybrid because there'll be seats, and you could go and you could eat your food there, and there'll be food service, but it's also wines, gourmet food, that type of stuff. It's a hybrid restaurant, like a cafe retail.
Got it. Yeah, I'm supportive. Tom, do you have any opinion on this? Is the administration supportive?
Yeah, the administration doesn't object to this. As Mr. Marrero mentioned, there are three changes to Section 142-310 of the LDRs that are proposed. If the Land Use Committee is supportive of this, it would need to go back to the Commission for a referral to the Planning Board.
Okay. I left my party pooper hat at home, my poop emoji hat at home. I'll tell you what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about outdoor speakers. I don't see that being addressed here, and I think I may have previously expressed this, so I don't see that being addressed here. I'm concerned that we're increasing the outdoors upstairs by 80, but downstairs I understand that on the public right-of-ways there could be potentially up to 57 outdoor seats, and that's a lot of outdoors, and so I need to know how are we going to control the noise from these people, especially above the ground level? You know, is anything going to be, is this code amendment going to require any roof or anything to control the noise of people? I don't need an answer right now. I haven't recognized anyone. My concern also having to do with the properties fronting Alton Road. If there's ever any unification of the property, of the Office Depot property, well, then now that also then fronts Alton Road. If there's a unification, there's a unified development site, so then would this allow that over there as well? I have concerns with this that have not been addressed. At one point, I had asked if there would be any limitations in short-term rentals. I was not given any real answer or commitment on that. But at the very least, as it relates to what we know generates the direct effects, outdoor speakers, the amount of outdoor seats, and how we handle the travel of that noise to the surrounding properties of people sitting outside, eating, drinking, having a good time. How do we control that noise from not affecting other properties? And then addressing in the legislation any potential unification of the current site that's under discussion with the Office Depot site. Until I don't see a draft language addressing all of these concerns, I really can't support that. Given the way this is drafted right now.
Party pooper.
Party pooper today.
Okay. Sarah, Marilyn, do you have opinions on this? Are there callers, by the way?
No callers so far.
Sarah de los Reyes, Sunset Harbor president and resident of Sunset Harbor. I have had discussion with Ronnie. I have had many discussions with him, and I did a proposal that we would actually give him 80 seats above ground until 11 p.m. or 12 p.m. so he's able to close the restaurant at 12 p.m. but no outdoor speakers. I mean, right now we have an issue with Moloko, which had outdoor speakers that inherited from the previous vegan restaurant, and disco music was playing that you can hear a block away from it. It was brought to my attention. I'm just repeating, and it was Mike, one of my board members, who went to Fresh Market and heard the whole thing. I can only act when I hear. I am not the policeman of Sunset Harbor, but I do listen to my residents on what they want to do. We do have ordinance of 8 p.m., and we did that because of Stillsville. It started with Stillsville, who wanted a rooftop. And they got the rooftop, but they were never able to build the rooftop because it didn't hold, the building could not hold the load. So we changed the ordinance to that just to make sure we don't have that in Sunset Harbor. So I tried, like I said, three times I would offer. It is a short-term rental, so I said if you can actually extend the time so it won't be like every day, like a hotel, people checking in and checking out, and we will actually sit down and come up with a way that you can actually, and I'll present here, that he can have open until 12 p.m. and have all the outdoors until about 80 seats to 90 seats. I tried that a few times. But you guys want to change our ordinance to something like that in Sunset Harbor? It's not fair. We worked very hard for our ordinance. And we are taking into account what he's trying to do in the restaurant, and we are. And we had discussion. It's not like we have had. No discussion, and the whole team was involved.
Tom, how would this be tailored? Would it be for all of Sunset Harbor, or can we sort of limit the area? Because this property faces sort of, east. There's no residents nearby, so I'm not sure, that the noise will disturb.
Oh, it is. Residents. There is, remember, there's the tower that's next. There's the white building across the bridge.
Yeah, that's pretty far away, but
no,
yeah.
That's not far away. Noise travels, guys.
Yeah. As Mr. Chair, as drafted, this would only apply to basically the southeast corner of Sunset Harbor. So it would basically apply to that lot that's bounded by 18th Street in the north, and then West Avenue to the west. To Vice Mayor Fernandez's point, potentially in the future, if they were to acquire the Office Depot site and aggregate it, then these regulations would apply to that larger site.
Mm. And just a quick question. And under the current regulation, would the Office Depot site benefit from this regulation?
Currently, no, because it's not part of that unified development site. But in the future, if the property owner was to acquire it and create a unified site, then it would be able to avail itself of it.
Can I ask a couple of? Yeah, but in there's no residential. I think on the other side of west of that is a public storage unit, so there's no.
Correct.
Yeah, the irony is that that Office Depot site, by the way, 20 years ago was a nightclub with late night thumping music until 5 in the morning.
Yeah, the zoning, just for everybody's clarification, the zoning to the immediate west of this site and the immediate north is largely I-1. And there is limited CD2 along Alton Road, but currently that's proposed to either be office or retail.
Yeah. Can I ask Mr. Finbarb a couple of questions? Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of, we'll get to.
Just
okay, one go ahead, and then we'll get to Mr. Finbarb.
Regarding the speakers, they are asking for speakers to kind of muffle the noise from Alton Road. So imagine, we have the noise of Alton Road, which is deafening. I went to the new pizzeria that they opened. I forget the name now. And we were sitting outside, and we could hardly talk, my husband and I, because of the noise of Alton Road. So now we have all the noise of Alton Road. They want speakers to project the music from inside to outside, and then the people talking. So the noise from Alton Road, the people talking, the music that has to be at a certain level, otherwise it will not help. It's crazy. I mean, why can people not just sit outside and enjoy without having to have some kind of music noise going on? The people in the lofts are the ones that are completely against this, because they hear everything in the lofts. What's his name? Adonis was like, please go there and make sure that they don't allow speakers. So, and it's going to be an in and out of people because they are having short-term rentals, which we begged them to see if they could work around that, and apparently they can't. So, you know.
Well, they had another proposal a year ago that you all didn't want because they wanted, you wanted 50 things, and they gave you 49 things. But the county wasn't going to allow the drop-off lane. So for that reason, they've got a new plan. What building do you live in, ma'am?
I'm Ricky's neighbor. I live in the townhomes.
So how far away? You're like two blocks away from this property, right?
No, not two blocks. Okay. But we are the neighborhood association, and we're talking in the name of...
This is a classic example, though, of why I asked Tom on the question on the last one on the pilot program, to look at whether or not there was any residential. This faces southeast, and there's no residential around there.
Especially the Lofts.
But the Lofts is like, is that the one on Purdy? That's two blocks away, right? But it's literally two or three blocks away.
This faces Alton Road and the car wash. The car wash might be very disturbed if there's ambient outdoor music, given that they're closed at night.
They're sarcastic.
No, I mean, but the fact is, Marilyn, we got to be factual. It faces southeast. It faces the canal, Alton Road, and Dade Boulevard. It's not fronting residential neighbors. And look, you also got to look at track record. You know, this man owns and built the Palomar, which has, I believe, a very nice restaurant. I believe you've been there. The Marini. And it's fantastic. And guess what? They have live entertainment because they're in the zone. And it's fantastic.
In Sunset Harbor is, if he gets them, everybody's going to want them. That is what the problem is. But, you know, that's how kids... Oh, he's got it. I want it too. And we got stuck already with Moloko, whatever the name is, because they were grandfather. But guess what? When Pura Vida opened, they had speakers outside, and we had to come to the city and ask them, you know, they're not supposed to. So it's
tragic that Pura Vida opened. It would have been so much better had it remained a funeral home. I mean, the thing is adaptive reuse. These are good things for our neighborhood. We enjoy places like Pura Vida and the gyms and all that. We can go back to what it once was, where we had funeral parlors and paint shops and body shops and all that, and then we wouldn't have to deal with, you know, a restaurant having outdoor music that is at ambient level. I mean, this is you know, what you want. We can go back in time.
We are in a residential neighborhood, Ricky. It bothers
me. That was created by zoning. Like, this is what we're doing today. We're trying to create a better neighborhood experience. I mean, Pura Vida is an amazing neighborhood enhancement.
It is.
But we have to support those businesses. Otherwise, they'll become funeral parlors.
No, it's a wonderful restaurant, and I love to go there. Sarah and I go there sometimes for lunch to talk. We don't want the music to drive us nuts.
But that's what you want. Some of us like music. You don't. Some of us do, right? I mean, this is
the
vocal minority putting their will over the people that are busy at work and can't be here today.
I put a child through Carnegie Mellon, and she's an excellent musician. So, I appreciate music more than anybody, probably. But there's a place for music, you know? There's a place for music.
Not in Miami Beach. There's no place for music in Miami Beach, apparently.
Well, then we should open places for music.
Well, that's what we're trying to do, but you're fighting us.
No, we're not fighting you. We are not fighting you. We want to work with you.
Okay. Mr. Finworth, okay. Do you have some comments here? Can you maybe give us some assurances?
Ronnie Finworth, thanks for having me. Commissioner Richardson, you had some questions?
Yeah, so... Describe, I don't know if you have a diagram, describe what the second floor restaurant is. Are you going to have any seats that are on the north, the west side?
Yeah, so the seats are facing south. The seats are facing south.
Towards the Palomar.
Towards the Palomar. So if anyone has a vested interest in the success and the experience of this, it's me, because the last thing that I want to do as a hotel owner is to compromise my guest experience across the street. So if we're going to be creating unnecessary noise, our guests are there, they're one and done. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, for purposes of this much smaller project, compromise the guest experience at my Palomar and my Marriott next door. It's not happening. So again, I hope you could appreciate We're here coming from a good place. We have secured an amazing operator for that space that we're talking about. And this is going to be something that the neighbors are going to be very proud of. It's filling a great void. It's you know, I've listened to Sarah, and I've listened to Marilyn also, as far as what they wanted to see here. Unfortunately, we were, you know, obviously we hit a wall with the first project, but we've come with a project that we feel is just is filling the void and answering what you're looking for. So 8 o'clock on that level, again, nobody could say that that's fair, because it's not fair, okay? The only people that would be impacted by those people talking are my guests across the street. We're not going to do that. We're not going to impact that experience. And we can't underestimate the noise that emanates from that very unique corner property that is fronted by three streets. I don't think there's another property that has frontage on three streets, 18th, Dade Boulevard, and Alton Road. And Alton Road has the highest traffic in all of Miami Beach. You know, so that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to kind of diffuse that noise with nice ambient background music on that level.
And so you're not going to have any outdoor seats on the north side of the second floor. It's only on the south side.
So the outdoor seats, it's kind of like a little, like a kind of like a pie shaped area that faces Alton.
Yep.
Okay. Faces Alton, and it faces south, which is the Palomar, and it's kind of like a pie that's kind of like facing Dade Boulevard.
Okay.
Right. And again, we wouldn't propose it if we thought it was going to impact our guest experience. To us, that's the most important thing. If you look at TripAdvisor, okay, TripAdvisor, out of close to 400 hotels in South Beach, the Kimpton right now is rated number 18. 18 out of 400, almost 400 hotels in South Beach. You know, that's showing that our team is doing something right there. That's pretty amazing.
And Tom, this would be limited to, it's not in the entire overlay of Sunset. It's just, what'd you say, to West Avenue?
No, this would basically be the southeast corner between West Avenue and Alton Road, south of 18th Street. So it's a very, very limited area.
18th Street is the street that this borders?
Yes.
The property border, so I think there's a car wash across the street.
Correct.
Okay. I'm supportive of this.
I am too. You want to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll make a motion to support this and send it back to commission with a favorable recommendation.
2-1 until 2-1.
Party pooper
today. Yes. I just want to know, actually, for the record, because I've been to Marini's, and Marini's, it really is such a great addition there. Is it the same caliber? Is it better? What caliber?
It is same caliber or better.
Same caliber
or better. It's arguably. I mean, I can't. It's same caliber or better. It is something that I feel if I released the name, which I'm not prepared to do right now, everybody would be super supportive. And it would be something that is filling a huge void in the neighborhood. And it's something that, you know, this is a tough corner, okay? This is a tough corner, and we think we've come up with something that is very, very fitting. And you will be, I'm very confident that Sarah and Marilyn and the rest of the Sunset Harbor neighborhood will be customers and clients, and you know, that could frequent and utilize our amenities.
Listen, the reason I'm supportive is because it's you, and I've seen the, and we don't know each other, but I've seen your projects and they're well done. And so, you know, because of your track record, I'm supportive, and I'm just trusting in you that you're going to enhance the neighborhood. That's why I'm supportive.
Thank you.
You know, one thing, colleagues, you know, and my neighbors who, you know, I love and respect, you know, the project that we have going up across from, the Maurice Gibb Park, I don't even know what it's going to be called, but the residential, what's it called?
The Deco.
Is that what it's called, Deco?
Yeah, the Deco. The 1800.
Yeah, 1800. But that's going to be a fabulous project, huh?
It's office.
No. I'm talking about
on Purdy Avenue, the big high-end residential mixed-use project. I don't know what they're calling it. No, it's more than one, but it's residential and retail on the. Okay, well, so hang on, because that's not true, because the first floor is going to be a fabulous sushi restaurant. Right, so it's not office. It's mixed use, which is what I said. It's residential, office, and retail. But anyway, so that's going to be a great project for our neighborhood. They're going to have a great restaurant, Uchi, which is...
18th Sunset.
Yeah. It's going to have a fabulous... My point is that our neighborhood keeps getting better because of projects like this. And I was citing the project, the mixed-use project that we all fought hard to get together. It's going to be fabulous. You and I were on the same side of that, but people resisted us. Yeah, but these things enhance our neighborhoods, and we have to be supportive when they're going to be accretive to our neighborhood. And I believe this project, which is a vacant lot, it's an eyesore, is going to be a really good project because we have a responsible party here. And we need to support projects so that they pencil out economically. Okay.
Marilyn?
Well, right now it's passing 2-1, so.
Yeah, so.
And when they come and say they want the speakers, we're going to tell them no, okay?
All right, so we'll show this approved 2-1. It'll go back to the full commission as a C4 item for referral to the planning board.
Yes.
Okay.
Did you tell me, Tom, that this has already been to the planning board once or no?
The project went to the planning board.
Okay.
But the project
was
not approved with these exceptions, correct?
Okay. But the project passed the planning board?
It passed the planning board. It just, we'd have to go back once this ordinance, if it passes, to add these items.
I got it. Okay.
Yep. Just for my own edification, not related to the project, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to educate myself right now and educate the public also. Since we're considering in second reading at the next meeting the warrant process, this would not be something that someone could get through a warrant, because this is a use. It's not an actual, it's not a different type of...
Correct. It involves things like speakers, which are not permitted.
Right.
And it involves number of seats, which is a use, which is not part of the warrant. However, if the commission wanted to, down the line, amend the warrant process to give yourselves that latitude, you could potentially do that later.
Got it. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, do you have any items that you want to call out of order?
I'm good.
Okay. And you guys are good on time?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. How about item number 10, Ocean Terrace progress discussion? I don't know if we have anybody from the public. Okay. All right. Sarah, be nice. Okay. Sarah, be nice. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, could I be recognized? Sarah?
You know, Mr. Finwarb, you should have just done the hotel. You should have sued us. You would have won that. But you were kind enough not to sue us and do an apartment building. So, I mean, thank you. Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, these are Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez. I don't know if she's here or participating via phone. There are a number of items here. Is anyone prepared to talk to her items?
I want to talk about number nine.
Number nine, okay. What do we do here? Because, like, for example, number 10, let me just, because I teed it up.
Yeah, of course.
Is there someone who, I don't know what this item is. Does somebody want to speak to item 10?
It is Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez's item. It was discussed at Neighborhoods last week, and good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. I'm happy to address it. I think the takeaway from Neighborhoods, the Neighborhoods kept it in committee, and I think that the desire for Neighborhoods was to understand the timeline better and to hear from legal and the administration in terms of whether there are any remedies under the development agreement, if there's any event of default, and what that looks like. I don't believe, and we have looked at this, and I don't believe that the developer is in default of the agreement. They have asserted a delay for a governmental permitting delay. There, if I could just step back, when we resolved the litigation that was pending, and so that the project and the park project could move forward, there was an updated timeline for the park project. So we updated the timeline for the delivery of the public benefits to the city arising from the Ocean Terrace project, and that came as a result of several shade sessions that we had with the commission, and then the settlement agreement was approved unanimously by the city commission at a publicly noticed meeting. So the critical path on the timeline was the issuance of a building permit for the park project. And so the deadline that was in the settlement agreement was September 1st of 2022. That was, of course, subject to future delays if they experience future delays specifically for permitting. And so they have submitted their application for a building permit. They have submitted all of their construction drawings. They have made all the payments that were due under the settlement agreement. They have obtained HPB approval for the park and for the project. And they've put us on notice that they believe that by the end of this year, in a few months, that the building permit will issue. And we don't disagree. It's in the process, and Eric could weigh in on that end. But it's in the process, and we believe that the building permit will issue. So in the context of can we default this developer, then what I advise that committee and what I tell you today is that even if we disagreed as to whether they're late or not and whether it's excusable or not, then we'd have to give them a notice of default and an opportunity to cure. And it's a 90-day opportunity to cure. And so long as they're diligently commencing the cure, there's no default. So when you have a developer telling us, and we agree that the building permit is going to issue yep. in the next 60 days, then there is no purpose really served in a default if you know that the developer is in good faith diligently pursuing the issuance of the permit, because all of those steps have been taken. So that's where we are today. The committee asked for the transcripts of the shade session to be shared, and I'm happy to send that to the committee members. I've also reviewed the transcripts, and I can confirm what I confirmed at the committee last week, that the timeline that we discussed that was a part of the settlement agreement was about the park project, not about the overall development. So that's just, I don't know if Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez is on the line or
Gotcha. Thank you for that. I have an opinion before I speak. Colleagues, do you have anything there?
Could I just
I believe you're, are you in neighborhoods?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, my view on this is, first of all, this developer, I think, also has a very good reputation in our city for doing great projects. This development team painstakingly cobbled together these properties, spent, I don't know how much money, but it's fair to say well over $100 million in accumulating all of these properties. They've gone through painstaking zoning changes that have gone before this commission and previous commissions. They have labored very hard at great expense to put together this development. We have one commissioner out of the six of us who, for whatever reason, has animosity towards this developer and wants to just torture them in committee. And I think it's grossly unfair. She's casting aspersions that they're somehow delaying. I don't know of a developer who has well over $100 million invested and gone through painstaking zoning changes to make a development like this feasible, who wants to delay a development. I think it's abhorrent that because of petty personal reasons, they have to be tortured and humiliated publicly by a commissioner who has an axe to grind for whatever reason. And I won't stand for it. I'm fully supportive of this project moving forward. And if they, if they have to sit there in neighborhoods, I ask my colleagues who sit there to be fair and help them move forward with this project, because North Beach
very much needs this project to go forward. It'll be an amazing enhancement to our city and to North Beach specifically. And I just think it's grossly unfair. This is why people don't want to invest in our city, because they get dragged before a commission who wants to torture them because of personal reasons. And I think it's unfair, so I want to be on record that I did hear snippets of that meeting, and it was really gross. So that's the discussion. Commissioner Fernandez, you want to talk about item 9? Well, that was a discussion. I don't know. I mean, Raphael briefed us, and so.
So can we show the item concluded?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it was her item. I don't know why it's necessarily here, but I think it's concluded. We discussed it.
Okay. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, you're calling item 9?
Yep.
Okay. So item 9, it's an item that's been placed here by our colleague, Commissioner Kristen Rosen Gonzalez. It's an item for the purpose of repurposing city parking garage to become workforce housing, and it's referencing the garage here at 7th Street, the Collins Southwest corner of Collins Avenue and 7th Street. And so since I can't speak to my colleague because of the Sunshine Law, I just want to just make sure that at least the city attorneys, that the planning department, you know, I'm not sure if my colleague is aware of the FAR implications associated with doing this. There are FAR implications here. Usually, these workforce housing units we're talking about a city-owned garage that the 30-year lease is coming to an end soon. But possibly converting that for workforce housing, typically that would mean a developer having a developer do workforce housing there. And I just want to make sure that she is aware that she would be increasing FAR for a developer at this garage. And usually these workforce housing agreements, Mr. Attorney, correct me if I'm wrong, they have like a time period. They're usually like for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and then it expires. Is that correct with the workforce housing rental caps?
Typically with affordable or workforce, there's a covenant with an affordability term. And it's usually
for a certain period of time.
For a certain period of time.
And then that expires, and then the developer keeps the FAR. And so I just want to make sure that my colleague knows of the implications of what she is proposing here in item number 9. And so that was the purpose of me asking you. There's such a need for parking, in fact, that I feel that what we should really be looking at is, you know, we can't afford to lose this parking. How do we preserve this parking for our low-income workforce, the workforce of the city of Miami Beach that depends on this parking that's going to be lost? Rather than creating more FAR for developers, let's preserve this parking for our workforce. That's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller on Zoom.
Okay.
Joseph Magazine.
Morning, Joseph.
Morning, all. As always, thank you for your time. There has been no bigger advocate for residential housing in our city than me over the last few years. So I commend and applaud and appreciate all the recent discussion on housing. I would just caution turning the 100% focus away from workforce and affordable housing and just including full-time residential housing. If you look at the inventory of our existing housing stock, there's plenty of organic housing that essentially serves as quasi-workforce and affordable. But our city has been losing thousands of residents. And to me, where we're losing it is in the middle. So I appreciate and applaud the efforts, but I do worry that all this discussion centered on just workforce and affordable housing will essentially stall our efforts, where really we should be making all progress to just bring full-time residential housing. Increasing supply is what is going to help with affordability. And putting more red tape around just having a workforce and affordable housing that has very strict income limits and thus very much more difficult to develop will really stall our efforts. So again, thank you for your attention on this. I do think you could just use some fine-tuning. but appreciate the efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. So I guess Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez is proposing taking this city garage and decommissioning it from a garage into making it workforce housing. Is that the idea?
We're not really sure, Mr. Chair. There was not a lot of information in the referral memo, and I did reach out to the item sponsor, and she said she wanted to discuss the 7th Street garage. And so I worked with our parking director to come up with the language in the memo that basically gives a summary of the current situation with that garage. As some of you may be aware, the 7th Street garage consists of air rights that the city purchased in 1993, and pursuant to the agreement executed in 1994 when that garage was finalized, it became public parking. The owner of the land, Goldman Properties, does have the right to purchase the garage back from the city after 30 years in 1994, and apparently they have approached the city about doing that. So that's where we stand. We did note that the administration does have a concern with a potential loss of that parking because it is a very significant amount of parking within a very significant area of the city that is very intense. And so anything that we can do to retain that parking, I think, would be worthwhile. So that's basically all that we really have.
Chair, can I? Yeah, Tom, it's my understanding that they have that right if they choose to buy it, right? So
correct.
It's not our option, it's their option. So it's my understanding they've approached the city. So have they expressed that they intend to use their right, or what's the status?
I know Monica has been in touch with them.
So I was on a call with them. They were actually reaching out for two reasons. Number one, they were reaching out to make sure that they confirmed what the termination of the 30-year time period actually was from a date perspective, to make sure that they don't miss a window, to let us know that they were absolutely very interested, and also to tell us that if we had any interest that they may be willing to try and negotiate something prior to the close of the 30-year window. So they absolutely represented that they were interested and that their plans, at least at this point, were to exercise that option.
And what is the window? Have you all determined the date?
I don't know that we have a firm date. I think that we're still trying to make sure that we've looked at all of the addendums and all of the execution dates, but I believe it's sometime in 2025 or 2026.
Okay. And if they exercise that right, they would have to buy it, and so is the price determined or would be appraised?
It would be based upon market rate at the time of the purchase.
Okay. Well, I think we have a strong need for parking there, so I'm hoping that we're going to be able to retain the parking, whether or not it's in our name or their name. And I think the point on the workforce housing is accurate. There's no FAR. So I don't know how you would do that. I think at this point, because of the measures that have been forward, you'd have to go to the voters if you want to get more FAR. But I think there's a need for parking, so I'm hoping we're going to be able to keep that parking there.
Let me ask, maybe I missed it, but what rights do we have? I haven't looked at the agreement at all, but do they have an affirmative right? If they want to buy it, is it like a put? They have the right to buy it, or we have the right to buy it as well?
No, it's right. Very clear in the agreement that at the end of the 30 years or the extinguishing of the debt, whichever is later, they have the affirmative right to purchase the property at market rate.
So, I mean, is this a moot point? Like, we can't make this workforce housing because they have the right to buy. If they say we're going to buy it, there's nothing we can do?
Correct.
So, I mean, again, so this is, our colleague being who she is, creating issues that aren't issues. Like, to make this workforce housing, yeah, it would be nice, but we can't do it. So why do we even discuss it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's insanity. But okay, so let's conclude it. This is a moot point.
I just have a question. Just 2 points. Because with the loss of parking, Mr. Attorney, and I think we've had conversations about this, and I mentioned it to you as well, Mr. Planning Director, I want us to look at policy. We've made policies for Washington Avenue and for the MXC to reduce parking requirements, but we've done it based on the capacity and parking that we have now. We can't eliminate altogether parking, but we made these policies because, okay, we have a certain amount of parking now, but we can't go below the threshold that we currently have, because then it's going to affect the policies we've put in place. And so to the extent that there's parking in the inventory that's being removed, I want to see policy that requires that replacement of parking. Because if not, we are going to find ourselves in a bigger problem than we're at. And the second part, Mr. Attorney, to the planning director's point, the memo that sent this over here was very vague. I'm tired of seeing on the commission agenda memos that are only one line that really don't tell you the intent of what one of our colleagues is putting forward on the agenda. Before I place something as a referral or anything on the agenda, I try, out of respect to my colleagues who have to vote on this, I try to put substance to it and thought, and I work with the administration. I try to meet with you guys to get feedback with the city attorneys as well. And I draft a memo so that you all know what I'm thinking, so the public, for the benefit of transparency, so the public knows what we're considering. And so when something comes to committee, the members of the dais know what's coming here. So I would like to work on a regulation that when we refer something to committee, it just cannot be a one-line memo, that there is actually, you know, purpose. It explains what the intended outcome is. What are we looking to actually do?
And if I can respond to that, we have a requirement that agenda items placed on a city commission meeting agenda have sufficient detail to give the fellow commissioners an understanding of what the proposal is. But obviously, it's up to, you know, we don't control what each member of the commission places on the agenda.
Yep. Thank you. Speak to your friend, Vice Mayor Fernandez, because this is how she operates.
I can't speak to her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can tell her.
Can't speak.
Just generally, you know, please refer items with some talking points so that we actually can deliberate, because we have no idea what's in her mind. Sometimes I wonder if she does. But item number 8 is also...
Just yes. To confirm, we're going to show item number 9 is discussed and concluded?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But Commissioner Fernandez raises an excellent point, and it's something that I had thought of, and this highlights it. To the extent that we're going to lose this property, and I'm not sure if they're going to continue it as a private parking garage, but if they were to repurpose it, and we would lose, I don't know, it's 700 spots. I mean, it's a lot of spots. So, Monica, we need to be proactively thinking about replacing this, because this could be a real big problem for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a big problem.
Yeah.
Not only in terms of parking, but financially with our bonding with our bonding capacity as well.
I'll stay on it if you want to stay on it, which is an inventory, particularly in the MXC. If we were to lose this, it's going to be a big problem. Where can we replace it? And then to the extent that we need more capacity, let's discuss, you know, how do we do that?
I had Mr.
Come on up.
And I had asked for the city attorney to work on legislation for me, but since we're in the sunshine, if you want to work together with me, sponsor together with me on this policy so that we don't lose.
Sir Marilyn, are you guys here for an item? Because is there an item, or are you just watching? Okay.
This item?
Okay. Do you have an opinion? You want to speak on it? Okay.
You want to come and say it on the record? Just so
Monica, jog my memory, because I've been an advocate for public parking, particularly in this neighborhood. We have a couple coming. There's some projects in the pipeline for parking in the MXC?
Not really. I do want to highlight also that although we have the small 12th Street garage, it's actually, and Monica Beltran, by the way, for the record, parking director. So we do have the smaller garage that serves basically the police station and also the government center over there, or the courthouse. We have a small on 13th Street, which is also quite small. It's 200-something spaces. We have the anchor garage, but we have a contract on that with the Lowe's and the Royal Palm that they can take up to 60, 70% of those spaces during peak time. So we don't have much parking there. And our salvation was really the 7th Street garage mm-hmm. with 600-plus spaces. So we need and we need public parking.
Yes.
Because if you come to have dinner at a nice place 100%. And you have to pay $50, $60 for parking.
Monica, what surface parking lots do we have in the area?
So we have small lots.
Small lots,
and,
yeah.
And we do have probably the largest one in that ADCD area is the lot that sits on, we call it P16, on Collins and 13th. It holds 50 spaces currently, but we do need to get ahead of that ball game.
Commissioner Fernandez or Tom, I mean, should we call for a public-private partnership, you know, whether it's a surface lot or somewhere in the MXC, for someone to come in and we would partner with them, you know, whether it's some zoning relief or public property to create some more parking, not just parking, but a real mixed use, whether it's office space or retail, to try to enhance the inventory. And it's not just the inventory, the parking, which is very needed, but also, you know, MXC is a very challenged area. We've got a lot of problems there, but to try to call on the development community to do a project that we would want to see, whether it's office use or, you know, particular residential workforce housing, something like that.
I have a question. So I hear about different developments that want to come into different parts of our city. Have we ever explored, because we always think of public-private partnerships, of the government coming, I mean, the private industry coming and building on government property and all that type of stuff. This is a smart way of leveraging. But with parking is an FAR exception, right?
Required parking is an FAR exception.
Required parking.
And main use garages are an FAR exception.
But let me ask you this. If, for example, we are land constrained within, especially this part of the city, and someone is proposing to do a project, could we partner? They're doing it on private land, but could we partner with them to say, okay, you're doing this project on private land, but we as a city want to build public parking as part of your project that we, you know, we'll pay for. We just don't have the land for us to do it ourselves, but we partner with you. We'll pay to do this there. It's not their required parking, but it's parking that we need. Would that be considered an FAR exception?
In the past, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, we have done strategic code amendments. We actually just did this for Lincoln Lane North in order to create a parking requirement for public parking. So we could do that, and we could tailor zoning legislation around something like that in order to maintain parking as an FAR exception.
Well, so you read my mind. It's exactly what I was thinking, which is creating something out of nothing, gaining parking, and then a development that actually is, you know, good for the city, mm-hmm. you know, creates jobs, housing, tax revenue, which is exactly Lincoln Lane, right? So like this stupidity of being against it, we are actually going to keep the same parking and more. Oh, and it's going to be covered. And then we're also getting offices, retail, and residential housing. Like, that's why it's a no-brainer. Oh, and by the way, millions and millions of dollars of annual income from the taxes that will generate. Or we keep it the way it is, which is just vacant surface parking, which is underutilized public land. What you're saying, Commissioner Fernandez, is exactly what I was thinking of. You know, in this area, do we go out to the development community and say, look, as part of your project, we want you to do your project, but we want to build parking there, you know, whether it's our expense or some kind of P3.
Right.
Nick, I'm fully supportive. I mean, if you want to explore it, you want to sponsor it, I'll be co-sponsor with you.
Let's work together on that.
Nick, did I say
Nick
anything?
Was looking into the legalities.
No, I wanted Nick to be able to comment. Did I say anything incorrect?
Oh, no, I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, obviously, one option is doing a solicitation for a joint development. The difference here with the code amendment that we did for Lincoln Lane is that addressed city-owned property and public-private on our property. I don't think we can require a private developer on their own property to provide public parking spaces, but we could offer zoning incentives for private development that provides public parking spaces.
Yeah, exactly.
If I could. So we have private parking, right, that's used by the public. So I'll call that private public, right? And we have public municipal parking lots that's owned by government, right? The issue here is controlling the cost of parking. Because if it's private and you're going to cost $50, $60 to come out here, we're going to continue dying. I mean, or we will die because
parking
becomes unaffordable, right?
But what we're saying, Monica, as part of a private development, us coming in and trying to get public parking within the envelope of a private development.
So,
under our price structure, under your jurisdiction as the parking director.
Correct, and that's ideal because we're losing 640 or something like that spaces. We don't need to gain 50. We don't need to gain 100 because that doesn't even begin to meet the need. You know, there's a lot of property on Washington that needs the support of parking. This particular parking lot that I'm talking about with the 50 spaces is continuously full, right? There is need, but we need to significantly or as close to as possible replace the parking that we're going to lose over on 7th Street. And I think that should be our goal. And I think it's been a policy and a strategy of the commission always, the city, to provide affordable garage parking so we can take cars off the street and alleviate traffic congestion. And to that end, we need to make it available. And here to help.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. We have one caller on Zoom.
Okay.
Matthew Galtanoff.
Okay. Morning, Matthew.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, commissioners. You know, I just want to talk. Look, I couldn't resist calling in when I heard this topic of parking come up here. You know, we have adopted master plans, the transportation master plan and other master plans, where the city has set a policy of trying to encourage mode shift. That is, you know, mode shift from the private automobile to perhaps transportation, that could be a rail link from the city, from the mainland to City of Miami Beach. You know, that could be other things within the City of Miami Beach, you know, bicycles and other micro-mobility devices. But it's important to be data-driven here. And there used to be a parking status report released every single month to show the usage of these garages. And while I don't doubt that this garage at 7th and Collins is very well utilized, if we just look not so far away at 5th and Alton, that garage is not utilized that well because there have been some issues with the joint venture. I've seen the LTCs and other documents. You know, the city and the other partner in the joint venture have to make contributions to make up for a shortfall. So again, there is policy on the city, you know, looking to reduce the mode shift from private automobiles to other modes. And you have to make these hard decisions as policymakers. And that includes, you know, looking at the data, that includes mass transit links and other things so that we don't have this situation where we said we have a parking shortage. Again, we need to be data driven in all these decisions and not necessarily rely on emotion. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Okay. Commissioner Fernandez, if you want to run with it, I'm fully supportive and maybe work together. But
sure.
Parking in the MXC for sure. But then creating, you know, going out, whether you want to go out to the private market and try to get some solicitations for ideas and projects, I personally think it's a very good idea, much needed. But I think it's something, you know, hopefully you want to run with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I started working already with the city attorneys and planning on some legislation and perhaps you know, soon I'll have a referral to this committee to discuss that further.
Yeah, I mean, in my own neighborhood, Sunset Harbor, I mean, I think, you know, Marilyn and Sarah, you might agree, the creation of that garage really was the catalyst to making our community explode. Yeah.
Mayor Levine.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So, and yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the one area of our neighbor, of our city that's really challenged, the MXC. And we got to do more other than just over-regulating businesses and stuff. We got to find a catalytic project there. We still haven't done it. Maybe it's a parking garage at P3.
And those most affected with this in the MXC, it's not us, actually, because I know most of the time I go into the MXC, I usually go in an Uber, so I don't park, or unless I'm out walking, that I may come from City Hall and go into the MXC, or if I'm walking from my house on the beach walk, that I go down to the entertainment district. It's our income-limited individuals who work in the district who end up being most affected. It's our employers who can't keep their employees because they can't even afford to park in the district. And I've heard the complaint from people who have looked at renting space to establish a business, and you know, they're hesitant because they don't know if they will be able to retain the necessary workforce for it. So so we'll work on this policy and with the support of the city attorney's office.
You know, here's an idea. Monica, how many surface parking lots does the city own in the MXC? Do you know offhand? And the question I'm going to ask is, do we put those into play? Do we go to the development community and say, look, you can partner with us on our land. They may have to buy the adjacent properties, or the adjacent properties will want to do something, partner with us, say, we'll put this into play. You build more garage parking, and we'd have to go to the voters, but get an additional FAR for workforce housing, office development, something like that. Like putting our asset into play to get the kind of development and additional parking that we need. So how many parking lots do we have?
So the largest, I could tell you that the largest is that P16 on 13th Street. The others have 30.
It's what, a quarter acre? If it's 50 spots, you said?
50 spots. As a point of reference, where the Collins Park garage sits, that had about 50 spaces. And that garage.
Which parking garage is that?
Collins Park? The G12? The new garage?
Oh, Collins Park. Oh, yeah. So that was, I remember, 50. Yeah. And now we got how many?
500 plus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, that garage has also been a catalyst. That garage is utilized, and 100%. It has totally lessened the burden of parking in the area.
Yeah, no, that has been a catalyst and will be a catalyst. That's a good example. So could we build a project like that on the
So I'm parking director, but I haven't constructed anything yet. I'm just use that as a parallel that we could really benefit from as much parking, replacement parking as possible.
I mean, if we're going to do a parking in the future, if we're going to do another parking garage like that, I would want to build workforce housing on top of it. And if we need to get additional FAR, would we need FAR? Because if the public parking is an exception to FAR, why aren't we building workforce housing on top? I mean, there's height restrictions, but we'd have to
if you built it as a main use parking garage, you can have under the code currently up to 25% non-parking floor area. The commission can increase that if you wanted to increase that to 35, 45, even 49%. You just couldn't go over 50%. The other option would be to do something along the lines of what we did at Lincoln Lane North, where you create a public parking requirement. That would be an exception to the FAR.
One of the things I would like us to look at in the future, and this goes now outside kind of what we're speaking here, but maybe a little bit more creatively, working with our neighboring jurisdictions, like Civic Center. Mm-hmm. I mean, not Civic Center, the Government Center downtown, right now there. Government Center has a few garages. It has a cultural center garage. It has
Dade County.
By the Orange Peel, it has another garage, and then it has a third garage where the tag agency is at. All those are garages that are used 9 to 5. And then at night, after government offices close, it literally gets shut down. There's a gate that comes and closes it. And just wondering, to help our workforce and support, you know, these individuals that they don't live in Miami Beach anymore because they can't afford to live in Miami Beach, but they live in Hialeah. A lot of them live in Opa-locka, or they travel long distances from Kendall. Could we establish something where we use public spaces that already exist in downtown that are underutilized, especially at night when the majority of our, you know, entertainment district workforce needs it, and in the weekends, and have a trolley service, a bus service, where they park there off the island, and then we bus them in. And I would like us to see if we can creatively find a solution for our workforce somehow using this asset that already exists that could be quickly implemented when it's not being used in the weekends and at night.
Yeah, we've done different initiatives for employee parking. I had a major hotel come to me and say, look, I'm losing employees. I don't have a place for employees to park. So think about the Fontainebleau. How many employees do they have? Think about the Lowe's. How many employees do they have? And I'm going to refer to my experience prior to the city. Think about Miami International. Think about all those employees that work for all those airlines. Could they park in public parking? No. They couldn't afford it. And there isn't sufficient. So, you know, and I just want to leave that out there for consideration, that we talk about workforce housing. It's an expensive proposition, and it puts people into, and it's a great idea, but I think that we could also look at workforce parking.
Yep.
And we did propose different solutions and initiatives in different meetings that we had, outreach, including the Fontainebleau, et cetera, promoting employers, paying for bus passes for their employees, promoting the South Florida commuter services for carpooling, et cetera. Nothing took off, but certainly a conversation to be continued.
And, you know, one of the things that I think we could even look at, just a lot of our workforce comes from the north part of Miami-Dade County, northwest part of Miami-Dade County. So, like, for example, recently they were discussing there's this direct bus service. And I got to get the details. I was speaking with someone about it recently. A direct bus service from a park-and-ride facility that's being constructed in northwest Miami-Dade coming to Miami Beach. And you know, and I was wondering, how great would it be if we actually had for our workforce, you know, a certain amount of guaranteed parking there so that these individuals don't have to get in their car and come all the way to Miami Beach in their car. No, they park at the park and ride facility, and then they come to Miami Beach to their jobs on the bus that's being provided from there. So I think we need to start looking more creatively at places to prevent the cars from entering the city and getting individuals into these other modes of transportation. Okay. So it's an interesting discussion, Mr. Chair.
All right. While we're on parking, Monica, number 12, discuss private parking lots.
Yes, and I placed this on the agenda just because in the past there has been confusion from individuals with these lots. They confuse a private parking lot with a public parking lot. And it's a great problem to have because it's great that we have these private lots available to our residents and visitors to supplement our supply. My concern is that because of the pay-by-phone that they use, the signs, the green signs that they place are very similar to the green signs that we have. And so the public gets confused and they see that green sign and they think, oh, I'm parking in a city lot. And so my suggestion was, you know, let's create some unique signage, a different color than that that's used by the parking apps for these private lots. Let it be a yellow sign or an orange sign that conspicuously says that the lot is a private lot. I've seen right now what the signs say. So it'll have, you know, the letters are not very big on the sign saying this is a private lot, and then somewhere on the upper left-hand corner says it's managed by this company. But unless you're really paying attention, you don't realize it. And so if we just had a conspicuous sign, an orange sign, a yellow sign, something that they would have to put outside and near the other parking signs inside their lots, just letting people know that it's a private lot, it would help. And it would also help in terms of towing. You know, I know that we these private lots perhaps may be more aggressive in towing, and that's their prerogative because it's mm-hmm. private property. But we as a government on public property, we typically only tow when it's absolutely necessary.
Correct.
And that's the difference. And sometimes people, you know, they may park on the street or they may park on a public lot and they may run out of time and they'll be like, okay, I'm going to be in my car in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, so I'm just going to risk it and not extend the parking because I'm going to be there in 5 and 10 minutes and I won't get towed in 5 or 10 minutes. On a private lot, you actually may, because if you don't extend the parking, you know, these people, they could call a towing company and you'll be towed immediately. So that's my intent. I just want to address it, just put more clarity out there when someone is entering a private lot so that they know.
So there is signage right now at the entrance to every private lot that says, you know, there's a private lot, and also who tows from there, so that people know, oh, if my car is missing, this is a towing company. So that's a requirement by code already. We will look definitely into making it clearer. And just as a general information, because I know you've all received this, we don't tow for non-payment. We issue citations. We tow for safety or restricted parking.
Right.
But we don't tow for non-payment. The private lots used to tow for, all of them used to tow for non-payment. Some lots have now opted for issuing those notices by mail. Like you park, they use cameras. You parked in this lot and you didn't pay, and they send you a notice, which, as much as I dislike them, I like them better than towing because it's so much more expensive when you get towed. We will look at the signage. There is already a requirement. And I think the big problem is when you have a lot adjacent, a private one adjacent to a public, like behind Trader Joe's, yeah. Where they're very close. Yeah. And over by Normandy, right? And so we've put sign that says municipal or public parking, private, so that people know, but it's very confusing.
Most people don't realize it.
They don't realize it yet.
They don't realize it.
We'll work on it.
Yeah, let's. Could we work together on some sign?
Absolutely. We need to make it flashier so the people can maybe catch their attention.
I don't know if the camera can zoom into this, but like, it says warning mm-hmm. on the top, but then you have to read the smaller print.
There's a lot of information.
You know, to really...
I sent an email to Tom, and he very kindly responded right away. But this was a shock to me. I was not aware that when a business is required to have X amount of parking in order to build, mm-hmm. you know, you're required to have 20 places, 5 places, whatever, that they can charge to park.
And what's what's your idea? Do you have
No. Yeah. I was shocked if they are, like in our building, we were required to have 2 spots by unit, and then all of a sudden we put a parking meter. I mean, that's kind of odd. So I was surprised that Tom indicated that the law doesn't say anything that they can or cannot. I mean, it just doesn't address the issue.
Yes, it's a good point. I've never thought about that.
But imagine, I mean, the city requires that X business has X amount.
Yeah, we require parking in most cases unless we waive it.
In most cases, and then...
But we are silent on whether they can charge or not.
It's like if Publix were to charge for parking now. I mean,
exactly. It's
sense.
Like Publix. If Publix were to charge for parking.
I mean, something to think about. I've never thought about it. But
that's a good point.
Going forward to green light projects.
I mean, it's like...
I don't think I think that might be a price control that we don't have the authority to impose on what a private property owner charges for parking on their own property.
Not the amount, but we could mandate that they make it free, not charge.
We can look at that.
I mean, the required parking, that's required parking. I mean, it to me, it does not make sense for required parking to allow them to charge, because then people they're going to be charging $20, $30, for example, and then people end up looking for cheaper parking on the street. And so it was then the whole purpose of requiring them to have parking.
Yeah, you require them to have parking so people can park there free and they don't have to be circling around or have to go to a municipal or a private lot. I mean,
that was a good point.
I was shocked when I saw that they were charging for something that had
which project are you thinking
that
about?
That had always been free.
Which project are you thinking about specifically?
Right next door to us, Combras.
Oh, yeah. They just started that. Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Right next door to us.
Oh, the office.
And then you know that we have 10 parking spots there, and now there's such a rigmarole on how they're going to do it so we can still use the 10 spots.
Yeah.
You know? But I said, what? Yeah, they're charging?
I know.
I mean, if I had a business, I really would like for people to come to my business and make it easy for them to park, if you ask me. And on the previous question, since I'm up here and I've got the mic, I agree with you guys 100%. I mean, I don't think we should be getting rid of our parking. And it's a twofold thing. There's a place for public housing and for affordable housing, but not every place is suitable for that. Not every location. So, yes, the beach needs affordable housing, but we need to find where it is appropriate for that.
Thank you.
My two cents.
Thank you. All right. So I think
we'll conclude that. We have a couple more items.
Yeah. Do we want to show item 12 concluded?
I think so, unless you want me to bring back the sign that we work on with Monica.
No, I mean, just run with it. If you want to bring it back, but otherwise we'll conclude it.
This is from Marinelli's property. Look how tiny that is there.
So. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys. Thank you.
All right, so we have a couple more items, and they're all yours. Items 3, 5, and 7.
I think number 3 could be kind of quick.
Okay,
let's do it. Number 3, let me open.
Okay, I'll read it. To discuss amending regulations on hours of operation and prohibited areas for packaged liquor stores.
So before I worked on a draft ordinance with a planning director and the city attorney, just wanted to get the feel of the land use committee on creating parity. Right now within the MXC overlay, we already have a 10 p.m. cutoff for liquor stores, for packaged liquor stores.
Actually, 8 p.m.
8 p.m. I'm sorry. It's an 8 p.m. cutoff for the packaged liquor stores. Then recently, we expanded the MXC overlay north up to 23rd Street. And in essence, then what has resulted is that we have two different closing times in the MXC. We have an 8 p.m. closing time up to 16th Street, I think. And then we have a different closing time, which I think is 10 p.m. Tom?
We have...
It's midnight. Outside of the 8 p.m. area.
They open it. They're not allowed to open until 10 a.m.
Right.
That's what it is. It's 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., whereas outside it's 8 a.m. to midnight.
Okay. And so my intent here is to see if we create parity. So the closing time is uniform within the entire MXC overlay for the packaged liquor stores. You're good with it?
Yeah.
All right. So then we'll draft Mr. Attorney an ordinance with the planning director to bring back before we send it to the city commission.
Do you want to bring that back in November or in January?
Do you want me to bring it back, or do you want me just to send it to commission?
Send it to commission, yeah.
To commission?
The only reason I'd ask that we keep it in committee is because of the two, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the two rulings, adverse rulings in the Cleveland litigation, we have to be very careful how we draw geographic boundaries for alcohol.
Yeah, so we can bring it back here.
I would suggest in
January. You just want to have uniform closing hours for liquor stores in the MXC?
Yeah, because of what Nick just mentioned, we have two different closing hours now, and so we want to create that parity. And so we'll just bring it back.
Do you have something in mind, or you just want to discuss parity?
Well, drafting the ordinance so that 8 p.m. Rollback on packaged liquor stores applies throughout the entire MXC overlay, because we expanded the overlay.
The Arteco, right. The Arteco overlay has been extended, Tom, I believe, to 23rd Street, right?
Correct.
And west to Washington Avenue. So what I believe Commissioner Fernandez is proposing is to extend that 8 p.m. cutoff north to 23rd Street.
Right. So that's uniform.
Okay. I'll discuss it. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with 8 p.m. That's a little early.
But that's what exists already. In part of the MXC overlay.
Is that right?
We extended the MXC overlay.
Is it 8 p.m.
from
the MXC?
From 5th to 16th Street, and from Washington Avenue East, the package cutoff is actually 8 p.m.
And then what happened when we expanded the overlay, now within the overlay we have two different closing times.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
And if it's okay, Vice Mayor, we'll bring this back in January because we wanted to get some data from the police department.
That's good.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Items 5 and 7.
5 and 7. Okay. So item 5 is what we've discussed in the past about how we can get better design in our public buildings that are paid for with taxpayers' dollars. Staff met with our procurement department. Because all of this starts from the solicitation process, and they've brought forward some recommendations. So with that, I'd like to recognize the planning director through the chair to present their recommendations.
Sure, and I'll be very brief. Under the update section of the Land Use Committee memo, we did meet with the procurement director, and we've come up with a couple of different recommendations that deal with creating additional criteria for future requests for proposals and future requests for qualifications, as well as enhancing the city department's internal requirements for evaluating their procedures for evaluation committees. If there's consensus on this, our recommendation would be that we conclude the item with direction to bring a resolution to the commission. It can be a consent resolution, and we will show the sponsor a draft of the resolution before putting it on the commission agenda for the commission to endorse this.
And Mr. Chair, I support the ideas that have been brought forward from you know, adding the criteria and the RFPs and RFQs to the evaluation committees, et cetera. I'm supportive of these ideas. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review them.
I have not, but I definitely support, you know, the concept of just making sure we have excellent design for any city project. It's something many, many years ago I also endorsed and supported. I think everything that we do is, you know, it's got to be first class. And for the most part, recent projects have been that way.
I think so, yeah.
But historically, governments in general design really ugly buildings, you know?
This building.
This building, the brutalist style, I believe, is what we would call this, is an example of government. A lot of the county buildings are just horrific, you know? Yeah, government centers, you know. We should always champion design.
Absolutely. Okay. So with that, we'll bring a resolution back to the City Commission, adopting these recommendations.
That's correct.
Perfect. Thank you.
Our last item is item number 7, also yours. Discuss the city's land development regulations to require additional information related to proposed FAR increases.
Actually, we also have item 8.
Item what?
Item 8 is, I think, the last item.
Oh, I thought we deferred that.
No, yeah, we deferred item 4, but we didn't defer item 8.
Oh, I marked it as deferred as well, but maybe that was my imagination. Okay, we have item 8 as well.
Yeah, I thought we were deferring 8 and 10 so that Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez. Oh, no, we did 10.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll do item 8 as well then. So
we have Public Works here for item number 8 as
well. All right, well, let's get them out of here. I didn't know what you guys were here for. I apologize. I would have called you guys up. I'm so sorry. I didn't know. I couldn't figure out what you were here for. Let's do item 8 so you can get back to
your
jobs there. Okay, so this is a discussion. To discuss a motion that was passed by the Ad Hoc Neighborhood Resilience Projects Advisory Committee. I didn't even know we had that. For the city to provide a timeline to accompany the prioritization of neighborhood improvement projects for the next 10 years in addition to an estimated budget. That's a mouthful. What is this?
Yes, sir. So this is just an update of the activities that we're currently engaged in. So two notable things that wanted to point out in the memo. Number one, we've undertaken an update to the stormwater master plan that was last done in 2011. It's about 11 years old, so we've already commissioned AECOM to proceed with an update to the stormwater master plan, and that's going to really provide us a blueprint going forward. In addition to that, we also have eGov rates engaged as our revenue consultant that is studying the current the rates for the stormwater program that were last updated in 2017, so we're looking at those rates again. And in addition to that, we also have a rate study undergoing for water and sewer, for our water and sewer program, because obviously they're tied together with these neighborhood improvement programs. They require extensive drainage work, which requires then the water and sewer work. So what we wanted to do is just to update you on our activities, what we're doing right now. The Stormwater Master Plan has about a year timeline. We can certainly come back in about 6 months and update you on the progress of the Stormwater Master Plan and how we're proceeding. No?
Sorry. So what do we do with this item? Do we just conclude it? Tom? I mean, I'm not sure where she's going with this.
Joe, unless you think that there's anything else the committee needs to discuss, I think that was the nature of
right.
the referral.
And so. Actually, this item is actually also on at FERC on Monday as well. So it's just an update on our activities.
And the sponsor, I believe, will be at FERC on Monday. So
okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right, so we'll show this as discussed and concluded.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. All right, our last item, item number 7, right? Yeah.
Item number 7.
This is yours to discuss the city's land development regulations to require additional information related to proposed FAR increases. So what do we have here?
Okay. Let's get there. All right. So ideally, in an ideal world, I would love to see when we're sending items to the ballot on FAR, potential FAR increases, that we be armed with more information about the potential development and the impacts associated with those developments with the extra FAR. Like, for example, a project or a site may have an FAR of 2. And we know that the person's coming before us that may be asking to go up to 2.5. We know what that person intends to build. We might know that they may want to do, 100 units or whatever it may be. But that's that person. That gets constructed 20 years down the road. Someone wants to buy the property, demolish what was built there, and then build something new. Well, we approved sending the question on the FAR to the ballot based on commitments made on some certain number of units. But now someone else, 20 years down the road, can come and inherit this FAR and build something different. And I think we would benefit if we would know, okay, what is the maximum residential that could be developed with this FAR, the maximum amount of commercial that could be created with this FAR, not just for the project that's in front of us today, but down the road in the future. What's that amount of square footage? And allowing then the commission, if they desire to get more information on traffic impacts or water and sewer impacts, stormwater capacity, all these other side impacts that we would be able to ask for it if the increase in square footage is really significant. But at the very least, I think we should get a report that tells us with this increase from 1.5 to 2 or from 1 to 2 or from 2 to 2.5, this is the maximum amount of residential and this is the maximum amount of commercial. And then at our prerogative as a commission, we could request further analysis on traffic, on water and sewers, and stormwater capacity.
Okay. I mean, what do you want to do with it?
Well, I want to create this requirement that when we have items that come before us in the future, requesting from us to put something on the ballot for an FAR increase, that we know, okay, if this passes, this is going to be the maximum amount of residential square footage that could be constructed eventually, or the maximum amount of commercial. And and then we would be able to get information on traffic or water and sewer impacts, stormwater capacity, et cetera.
Right, so FAR increases have to go before voters. So yes. You're saying that when these things come up, we would have adjacent requirements to specify maximum residential units, traffic impact, these corollary items?
Well,
So where I'm going with it is are you saying that it has to be on the ballot? Because then we have ballot language limitations.
No. I mean, us, before right. So, like, for example, I know, like, for example, with the DuVille. Mm-hmm. With the DuVille, we know the DuVille is, what is it built as now? Like 500 hotel rooms?
Now.
And then when Mr. Ross came with Mr. Geary with their proposal, we know what they were presenting to us was a reduction in the amount of hotel rooms and then also creating the condo tower, which I think one had 150 hotel rooms and the other one had like 170 condos, and that's under that plan. Mm-hmm. Let's say that plan doesn't come into fruition. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the maximum amount of commercial square footage that would be allowed on that property under the FAR we sent to the voters. I don't know what would be the maximum amount of residential square footage and the associated impacts with that. That's what I'm looking at. Not project specific on the amount of units that someone is proposing when they're requesting the increase in FAR, but just in general, what would this FAR now or 10 years down the road allow in terms of development on that site? Thinking about the owner 2 and 3 deals down the road.
So what you're asking is to have a requirement to specify those
things? Yeah, when it comes to us.
I mean, that's something we can just do as a body, right? So somebody comes to ask us to put something on the ballot for FAR increases, we can simply ask Tom, what would be the maximum number of units if that FAR were to increase? Like, I'm not sure we need a regulation to do that, because that's just something we do as part of our due diligence.
And part of what I think we should be receiving, and it sounds like we're probably going to be at a tie vote here.
Like, what's your concern? Like, if you want to use the DuVille specifically, did people raise concerns that
it's independent from the DuVille, by the way. It has nothing to do with the DuVille. I remember, like, for example, at the county, mm-hmm. when these items go before the county commission. It's different there because it's actually the county commission that's approving this. It's not the voters. So there they would know, okay, under the requested FAR, this is the maximum amount of residential, the maximum amount of commercial. Sometimes it would say this would be the maximum amount of residential and this is the maximum amount of commercial within a mixed use, for example, and these are the potential traffic impacts on this A-rated road. The A-rated road could drop down to a C-rated road, and you could potentially have issues at this left lane, and you may want to consider reconfiguration, or you may want for the developer to eventually, do corrections to this intersection to improve the capacity of it. This is the potential water usage of this site and the potential sewer impacts that it could have. Having that information when we're deciding to increase or to send to the voters these increases in FAR, which I think is responsible for us to have, because we might find out about needs of the area that then we could get the developer to address as part of even of a public benefit. Because sometimes we negotiate public benefits, I feel, that are more political than actually real benefits for the community. And I think if we have this information and now we know, okay, there's an issue with traffic flow at this side street where the level of service is going to drop because of the new development, well, then perhaps the developer could help us, you know, facilitate improvements to that road. Or if the level of service of the sewer system is going to drop and you need to do improvements, well, then perhaps then the developer could come in and help with those improvements. But we will know what the impacts are when we're getting this data.
Mr. Chairman, could I weigh in? The state of the law now is that at the time a final project is submitted, the planning department is required to do an impact analysis of what that project will have on existing infrastructure, schools, water and sewer, transportation, parks. I think what Commissioner Fernandez is proposing is maybe getting some of that information, or maybe preliminary information, mm-hmm. up front when the applicant first submits their request for an FAR increase. The other analysis that we do is whenever we amend the comprehensive plan, whenever we're increasing FAR, there's a companion comprehensive plan amendment. That draft amendment has to be submitted to the reviewing agencies, and we get comments on what that additional impact of development will have on our infrastructure at that point as well. So there may be some overlap with existing requirements, but I think what I'm sorry, Vice Mayor Fernandez is proposing is getting preliminary information up front.
Right. Because the information is available, and the data is already collected. We're just not requesting it. It's not provided to us right now.
Well, and the information is usually available once a final project is submitted. But I think maybe preliminary information up front would address what you're looking
yes.
for.
Yes. Yes. And is this complicated? Like, if someone is coming to us and they're asking us to go from 1.5 to 2 FAR. I know. Like for example, with ballot question 7. You know, before I approved to put ballot question 7 on the ballot, I asked the person that approached me about it. I need to see the impacts, and they got me reports with impacts, which is consistent with what I'm doing here. It seems to me it's not difficult to get these reports, and it's not onerous to get these reports, Mr. Planning Director.
No, I think that it's something where you could do it one of two ways. The commission could require it, or individual commissioners could ask for it. Or if you wanted to make it part of the code in kind of the drop-down menu that you were talking about, where we could create a section applicable to all zoning districts prior to a ballot question prior to a question placed on a ballot for an FAR increase, or prior to any FAR increase, the following minimum information shall be required.
Yes.
Commission may, in its discretion, seek additional information related to the other things.
Right. And it's not onerous, because in general, they already probably have this information. And so, Commissioner Riola, if it's fine with you, I would like to work with them on drafting that policy and bring it back.
So
for our consideration.
Go ahead. I'm not sure I'm supportive of this. I just think it might just be, you know, over legislation. I mean, we don't really have that many things that go before voters for FAR increases, and when they do, they go through a fair amount of due diligence. So, you know, I don't want to create legislation for legislation's sake, and I know you don't either. But, you know, go ahead and do what you
feel like doing, and we'll look at it. We'll look at it. Yeah.
And my point is, so that we know before we send it to the voters. That's my thing. Before I send something to the voters, I want to know what the impacts are to make sure I feel comfortable sending it to the voters. Because sometimes what will happen also, as you've seen, is that people will come and they're going to say, oh, it's going to destroy the traffic in the area. But the data may help us understand better what the real impacts are rather than a hypothetical.
Yeah, I understand what you're getting. You know, my opinion on that is when we do those traffic impact studies, infrastructure mitigation, all these things, people will say, well, that's a phony report. You know, that, you know, it's so like you can, no good deed goes unpunished. Nothing we do will satisfy skeptics. You know, and so we can do all those things you're mentioning. I don't know that it solves the problems. Naysayers will be naysayers, you know.
This helps us with decisions.
Yeah.
We have one caller on Zoom.
Okay. Who is it?
Daniel Serrato. Oh.
All right, Daniel. Good morning or afternoon.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. And I've been listening in a lot of really interesting topics today. And thanks for all of your hard work. This item, I think, is a really interesting idea. People are asking questions about ballot questions, you know, that are on the current ballot. And honestly, I think we all agree our voters are smart. They want to have the information in front of them. I think it would make all of our lives easier if the ballot question itself had the information in it, like, okay, here's how many square feet extra you'd be approving compared to now, for example, you know, should the FAR be increased from 3 to 4 point whatever is not as easy for the layman to understand as, you know, should it be increased to allow for this maximum additional square feet. I think overall it would just help alleviate all the questions and make it more clear. So it seems like it is a matter of good policy, and ballot questions shouldn't really be vague. So this would, you know, be helpful if it also applied, hopefully, in the future. As you said, Ricky, it's not that often these things go on the ballot. But when they do, and when there's so many questions, I think it would help that these questions are a little more detailed. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel. Okay.
So by acclamation, can we bring this back in January and the administration will work with the sponsor on coming up with some legislation for that?
Yeah. Okay. I'm good with it. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. And that's it.
All right. Great meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
We ended ahead of time.
Yep. All right.